I'd like to call to order the Tuesday, April 21st, 2015 regular board meeting of San Luis Coastal Unified School District. We have all trustees present and accounted for. At this time, we will open the floor to public comment for items not on the agenda. If you have public comment about something that is on the agenda but don't wish to stick around for the agenda item to appear, you could also speak now. Public comment is limited to 3 minutes. If anyone has anything at this time, we also request that you turn in a slip to Mrs. Holmes. Oh, who has already given them to Mrs. Roger. All right. So, Mrs. Roger. Yeah, you want me to do that?
Thank you.
Oh, you know what? I just did this wrong. I was looking at the public comment on closed session, so I'm ahead of myself. So everyone sit tight. Okay, so we met in closed session and discussed conference with labor negotiators, anticipated litigation, and real property. So at this time, we're at number 4.0. Do we have a consensus on the order of business?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So at this time, we'll approve the look at the minutes of the March 31st, 2015 special meeting. Any comments, revisions, Mr. Quesenberry?
I'm going to move approval of the minutes. Ms. Holmes has my one revision.
Okay. Is there a second? March 31st? Okay, so we have a motion by Mr. Quesenberry, second by Mr. Millar. All in favor? Yes. Aye. Opposed? And then one abstention. Mr. Unger is abstaining. Okay, next we have to approve the minutes of the March 31st, 2015 regular meeting. Any comments, revisions? Mrs. Roger? Do you have anything? Oh, I thought you were going to comment.
I contemplated a comment, but decided against it, but I'll move approval.
I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion by Mrs. Rogers, second by Mr. Quesenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Abstaining? All right, motion carries. Then April 14th, 2015 minutes. Any discussion? Okay. No? Mr. Quesenberry? Yeah. Okay, Mr. Buckman has made a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second.
All right, you're just this. Yes, please do. Yes.
But you're here.
Okay. So all in favor?
Aye.
And then I think we have some abstentions. Yeah, Mr. Unger, Mr. Millar have abstained. All right. Next, Jono, you're on. Get serious.
The actions of one Mr. Millar were distracting me.
They always do.
But he's fine now. He's a good kid.
That's so terrible.
So I'd like to start out by saying that I brought along our next year's ASB president, Bella Stenvall, right here. So she's going to be taking over for me. I give her a clap. She deserves it. She's got size 11 and a half shoes to fill. So big, but like weirdly unproportional to the body. So big nonetheless. But starting with what's going on around campus, we had FFA go to Fresno for the state championships, and they won, which was awesome. Our chapter won. They also won our advisor, Anna Bates, number one ag teacher in all of California, their parliamentary procedure. Oh, we've got a lot of claps going on. Yeah, More people, like, we actually get claps. I like this. Yeah. Yeah. We should be bringing more people in more often. We also got the best chapter in California and the National Chapter Award, which is really awesome that we have that going for us. And we'll be heading over to, I believe, Kentucky in the summer for state or national championships. Up next, we have our Tiger Fest, which will be, I believe, this Thursday. It's at 5:30 for new parents, 6:30 for current parents. So what you would see is a bunch of booths for the different departments and different clubs. I know we'll be running an ASB club booth there where you can buy spiritware and just talk to us about ASB. And it's a good way for parents and incoming students to check out what the school's really about for their 8th graders going into 9th grade next year, and also for current students, for their parents to come and see, like, what the progress they've made. And, you know, maybe you want to take this class next year because this department looks really cool. We also had the Black and Gold Golf Tournament this weekend, which was a huge success. I know we had a bunch of people from outside and inside the school, both staff and administrators, along with students playing as well, and it was, as I said, a huge success. Now, Black and Gold brings in money for arts, academics, achievement, and activities. One specifically, they bought the rights to the play going on right now, good lead-in, Hairspray, which is showing this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. I hear it's a hoot and a half. My words on that. I just alter them a little bit. On Thursday and Friday, they'll be performing at 7, and on Saturday, they will be performing at 1 and 7 o'clock. All of those times will be in the theater at Slo High's campus, so you should go and check that out. I know I'm going to go. I haven't gone yet, but it's going to be great. We also had our Skills USA go over break to the state championships. We had a bunch of gold medalists. Our industrial tech won first by only a couple of points, and out of, I believe, 1,000 points. So they're going on to Kentucky as well next year for some really cool national tournaments. I know our team went last year, and I'm glad that we're going again. We also had one Trevor Porter who did really well in our county Skills USA. He won gold. Now he won gold in computer tech for the state. He will also be moving on. Super smart kid, super good with computers. And in personal news, I got to run the superintendents for the day around on last Friday. And let me tell you, those kids were the sweetest. Two brothers, 7th and 8th graders. Oh, my God, that just plucked each and one of my heartstrings. Yeah, they were the... It's okay to say cute when you're, like, older, but I'm 17, so at that point it's, like, a little weird. So they're really cool. And it was good to give them a good view of the campus in action. And also in personal news, I just recently committed to Portland State University. So if any of you need me next year, which I know you will, it's okay, you know. You know where to find me. It's just a quick flight all the way up to Oregon. And I'll be there waiting for you. So that's all I have to say today. If there's any questions, I'd love to take them.
If you happen to be in town, will you come by the board and let us know how you're doing?
Oh, definitely. I'm going to be here. If there's a board meeting and I'm in San Luis Obispo, you know where I'll be. The hottest place in town. All the kids going out, you know, doing activities and going to dances. They're missing out. This is where the real action is. All right.
I believe there is an administrator also who won an FFA distinction and will be going to Louisville. Are you aware of that?
Oh, yeah.
That would be. That's okay. You don't have to.
No. I heard about that, and I thought who told it to me was a joke. I thought it was like I didn't know that was an actual thing. So I thought they were like, oh yeah, they got it too. But I believe it was Mr. O'Connor, right? Yeah, administrator. I thought that was a joke. It's very believable. Yeah. I just didn't know it was an actual thing. But here we are. Congratulations, Mr. O'Connor, as I'm sure you're hearing about it right now. I love you, and please don't make me retake senior year.
I'm sure he'll understand, but it is quite a distinction. He went from regional administrator for FFA, so it's someone who champions FFA, and then now he's representing California in Louisville, so
well,
that's a big distinction for
him. I'm glad I know it's a real thing now. All right, well,
as usual, thank you very much.
Well, I'd love to stay, but, you know, I got to make sure all those other kids know how cool this is, so got to go let them know while they're coffee shops and cool hangouts
okay.
to come next time. So thank you.
Thanks, Jono. All right. Next on the agenda is the California Healthy Kids Survey. Thank you, Frank.
I received my 20-year employment pin from the personnel office of San Luis Coastal, which means I've known this guy for 20 years now at least, and so here in what is a semi-annual presentation, we have our own Frank Warren, who has a title now that's too long for me to remember. But Frank is here to share some countywide trends and, more importantly, some district trends from our latest iteration of the California Healthy Kids Service. So, Frank.
Years later, but I like being back here with the board. I'm excited to be invited back, and mostly just to start recruiting all for volunteering at the 24-hour relay. But we'll get to that afterwards. So let me run through this. So I don't know if we can get to the beginning of the report, but I want to walk you through again what I've done for a few times now over the course of the last few years, walking you through the California Healthy Kids Survey, how it works in San Luis Coastal, and some of the results, some good news, and some things that we can talk about in planning for the future as well. So first thing to know is that you have a really good sample size, and I'll just kind of nod over here and I'll let you know when to do I have switching power? Oh, I'll take switching power. As I was saying, so your sample size is very strong. You had 96% of your seventh grade. This is done in a two-year cohort, so the same group of seventh graders that take it now will be the ones who take it at ninth grade and 11th grade. You also have non-traditional students, those students who are possibly in your continuation schools, are taking that under that NT category. Most of what I'm going to report to you tonight comes from your 7th, 9th, and 11th cohorts. So a good, strong sample size all the way around. The nice thing about your district is that you do it with passive consent, meaning it has to be opted out rather than opted in. That gets you a larger sample size, and we find that to be the districts that do that have the best data to work with. We try to focus on certain things that a lot of people look at the data and they start to focus on, like lifetime use, and I will share that with you, but what we try to do is focus on current use. We think current use, what's happening in the young people's lives right now, is the most important indicators to look for. Alcohol continues to be the most used drug. You hear me say that every time I stand here. That has not changed. But marijuana use and prescription drugs remain kind of the things that we are keeping the most eye on, because there are still significant issues in this district and almost every other district as well. So it's not a San Luis Coastal specific issue. Make sure everything kind of lines up here. So the most important thing to report is that I don't know really how to put everything on one page at one time. Most important thing, as always, is a vast majority of young people are not using alcohol and other drugs on a regular basis. And I think that's important to start with, and we tend to speak about this pretty regularly because the perception is completely skewed. Even amongst young people, most young people think that everybody else is doing it. I think that they're told that a lot by the adult culture, that every young person is doing it, when we know for certain that that's just not true. These surveys give us really good data to prove that. So we should change that message with young people, that the majority and the norm is one of non-use for young people. All right, let's just keep clicking until we go here. So let's take a look at some of your lifetime use. You'll see across, if you see a green number, that means there's been a 5% or more change in the right direction. If you see a red number, there's been a 5% or more change in what we would probably say the wrong direction. And that numbers that you're looking at on your slide there, the big number is your district. The first smaller number is the county's rate, and then the next number is the state rate. The state has not done its biennial survey for a couple years. So this data, the state data, is a little bit older than the county or the San Luis Coastal data. But as you can see, we've had improvements with lifetime use. This is the one time using alcohol, cigarettes, or marijuana, or prescription drugs per those age groups. So seventh graders have reduced. Ninth graders have, for the most part, maintained with some improvements around cigarettes, especially for 11th graders. Of course, in our prescription drugs is where we're seeing now some major changes in that they are becoming more of an issue. Prescription drug abuse is not measured the same way at the seventh grade level, so you won't see that number reported for seventh grade. I think more importantly to focus on is your 30-day use. So this is a current snapshot. Nationally, this is the figure that is considered the performance review standard, and that is past 30-day use. And in this case, we've had some improvements. Again, alcohol down for seventh graders. That's across the county and state as well. And some improvements countywide in ninth grade and 11th grade. Black numbers just mean this: the district has maintained right around the same ballpark without a major shift in one direction or another. You know, you can look at that and say, well, you know, a quarter of our juniors have used marijuana in the last month. That number relates to the county as well as to the state. I think that's a significant number, whether that's an improvement or, you know, or not. It's something that you should be talking about in your school planning, your health classes, your counseling, you know, planning. And we're going to get to some of the trends that we've been seeing in counseling down the road as well. Sorry again for some of the shaky slide translation here. Let's get everything up here. So some of the key variables to pay attention to. We know that our juniors are doing having some improvements in their binge drinking rates. In fact, in this last report, which was done last year, or the measured last year, the report got back down to 24%, which it hasn't been that low since 2007. So that's a really significant increase. Actually now lower than the county average as well, just by a percentage point. Why is that important? Well, that means that the messaging is changing. We're figuring out how to talk about over-drinking, and we're doing it differently. So, for instance, we're very involved with Aware Awake Alive, which is a Cal Poly-based. It was, you know, came from the Starkey family after the death of Carson Starkey, a 19-year-old who died from over-drinking, or an alcohol overdose, actually, on campus. It's allowed us to talk about over-drinking in a different way in our community. Even though we may not be using the same tools on a high school campus, the message around excessive drinking is a little bit different in San Luis County now because of that. And I think the San Luis Coastal students are reflecting that in that binge drinking number. But there's also been some environmental changes that have been made, which have made it a little bit more difficult to get a hold of large amounts of alcohol. For instance, our social host laws, which have definitely had an impact on the amount of adult-provided alcohol. So there are some good things that you'll see there, including the reduction of numbers of young people who report being drunk or high while at school.
Frank?
Yes?
Excuse me just for a second.
Please.
Could you define binge drinking just for background?
Sure. I tend to use the term over-drinking. Binge drinking was defined by the Harvard Medical Group back in the mid-2000s as four drinks in a short amount of time for a male adult, five drinks in a short amount of time for a female adult. I have that backwards. Did I have that backwards? I have that backwards. Sorry. 4 for a female, 5 for a male. The problem with that is that, as you know, everybody's biology is completely different, and so just being male or just being female is not really an indicator of how much alcohol your body can absorb. So we tend to talk about over-drinking, which for you might be different than it is for me, which might be different for anyone else on the panel here. So really it is a large amount of alcohol in a short amount of time. Uh-huh. And then, again, the rate of growth of marijuana use, and a lot of this is pretty simple. Obviously, it says up there, marijuana use grows 12 times between 7th and 11th grades. There's a lot of changes in those grades. A lot of access is differently. Access is different. Norms are different. The way we talk about the drug changes. You know, you remember 7th graders are coming off a 6th grade year of hearing a lot of information about why drugs are bad and, you know, negative effects. That message starts to dissipate in 8th and 9th grade. And that might be something for schools to talk about, how we are staying consistent with that messaging from 6th grade on. So I think that's part of the reason why you see, but I think access is the biggest reason. Okay, why does this matter? And I share this with you when I'm here again. This is some more recent data in how current alcohol use ties directly to grades. And it's a pretty simple graph. The more you drink, the lower your grades on a regular basis. The more you binge drink, the lower your grades. The more you drink on school property, the lower your grades. So we do have an academic tie, and it's the same goes for other drugs as well. Marijuana is the same. Prescription drugs or prescription drug abuse or misuse is the same. Inhalants, and then you see ecstasy, which is another drug that we do see countywide being abused a great deal by high school students. So we know that there is an academic connection, so it is important that we continue to talk about it. Yeah, please.
How come methamphetamines aren't included in this?
Methamphetamines were not included in that last. They are included in the survey. I'm not reporting meth because the numbers are pretty low in terms of what's currently happening in your district, whereas, you know, 10 years ago we were talking about meth. We're seeing more heroin now. We're seeing more psychedelics. Meth still exists. Don't get me wrong. We still have young people that are abusing methamphetamine, but not at great numbers enough to make it to this discussion right now.
So can I just tack on to Chris's question really quick?
Yeah.
So we're also seeing some synthetic drugs, so synthetic
spice marijuana and things like that.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Yeah.
I can't keep up with
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, we're not asking specifically about those.
No, the survey doesn't ask synthetics.
Is it time that we start this almost feels like 1950 at this point.
We weren't asking about prescription drug abuse 10 years ago either. And
okay.
So, yeah, I think there will come a time where the state looks at these measures and says, well, you know, as the drug trends change, we should ask it or add things on. We assume that some of that comes up in the other drug categories. You know, you ask a young person about other drugs, and if they know that synthetic is considered a narcotic or a drug of any type, that they're going to report that. You know, as well. But yeah, we are seeing it not at, you know, I like to kind of caution people. Again, your synthetic issue is there, and it's significant because it's very dangerous. It's addictive. The access is greater. But it's nothing on your alcohol and marijuana issue. And that I would say that to any school board in any district.
Okay, and then just quickly, has the CHKS, has it kept up with the whole vaping? This is 2013. In 2013,
no.
I never heard of vaping.
Yeah, no, vaping has this survey was prepared for the county, I think, a year before vaping became a term, and certainly before we started working with tobacco control over local legislation. But I have a feeling just like prescription drugs and then synthetics in the future, we're going to be talking about the use of vaping pens, et cetera. And we'll talk about it a little bit when I wrap up here today. We continue the trend of females reporting more drinking than males. That's something that started about 10 years ago, and it's sadly become the norm that we don't really have an answer as to how to better address prevention with young women. So that's something that we talk about in our department, and I know it's something that schools should be thinking about as well. We still have, you know, obviously any amount of young people getting behind the wheel of a car while under the influence or with a friend who's been drinking is horrible, and we need to pay attention to that, keep that message alive. I was very, proud of San Luis High for doing its every 15 minutes program last year. Atascadero High, Cambria, other schools are, doing theirs in the years coming, and so we'll keep that rotation going so that hopefully every young person gets an opportunity to talk about that message of drinking and driving. Access still becomes our biggest issue in our county, and that's partly because our county is an alcohol-driven economy to some degree. We have a lot of people who give, regular mixed messages. Our news gives regular mixed messages on alcohol every night. We tell young people during the day it's bad for you and it's not a way to get ahead, and at night we talk about how much money it'll make you and how great, and healthy it is for your heart, etc. So we still have a mixed message issue in San Luis County that our young people show, and part of it is that they show it in feeling that alcohol is less harmful than other drugs, which, is a message that schools can help us, with. But that access, that ease of getting a hold of things still remains an issue. But like I said, we do have some reduction of the number of young people reporting being drunk or high on a school campus. Sorry for the crazy clicking here. Okay. So perceived harm is something we measure pretty regularly, and that's an important one to pay attention to when these reports come out. This is a real direct result. The higher a perceived harm, the lower the rate of use, pretty much across the board. Our young people are starting to report that their perception of the harm of marijuana is falling. So we should expect that. We live in a nation now which is grappling with the use of medical marijuana, the legalization of marijuana, and so the messaging around marijuana has softened a great deal just in probably the last 5 years. We need to be prepared for that. That means there's going to be more use. That means there's going to be more use on campus. There's going to be more discussion and openness about it on campus. I'm hoping that school faculties are talking about how they message. This is the same as with alcohol. We should be talking about how faculties talk about their own use. Once something, alcohol is a legal product, and so adults talk about using it legally. Are they giving a mixed message? We need to prepare for that. Our department has taken the stance around the legalization of marijuana that we're ready to be prepared for if it were to happen. All of the things, the lessons that we've learned from alcohol, the alcohol industry, how it targets young people, et cetera, we need to be prepared in the same way. But we need to be, armed with facts about the realities of any of these drugs. And marijuana, I think, is going to be our big topic in the next few years. Sorry, clicking here is here. There's the rest of it. But what we've done really well is we've scared everybody out of using cigarettes. We've done really well with that. Young people report pretty regularly that their friends or their parents would be far more upset with them for smoking cigarettes than it would be for using other drugs. I think that's a reality that we just need to acknowledge and address. Okay, let me wrap up here with a couple highlights. One of the things that your district has always done very well and we're really happy to partner with you on is showing the importance of counseling. Most people who do start using alcohol or other drugs start it while they're in school. And so school is the safe place where a lot of times they might be able to express their need for help, or the signs for their needing help are going to be more obvious than even if they were at home or in their neighborhoods. And so having counseling available on campus is a huge benefit, and your district has done very well with that. Some of the things that happen on your campus, and I'm very happy Brittany Gregory from our staff, who's one of our school counselors, is here with me tonight. You contract for our services from behavioral health at Morro Bay Pacific Beach and San Luis Obispo High School. We've actually started some drug Medi-Cal billing at your Pacific Beach site, which is certified for drug Medi-Cal. That's a very major step forward, and I applaud this school district for that, because we're going to be able to treat young people in the most appropriate level of care where they go to school. We provide, through the Mental Health Services Act, student assistance programs here at Los Osos Middle School. And then San Luis Coastal launched its own student assistance program with our staff at Laguna this year. We're very excited about how those outcomes are looking. And we are seeing some good results. I can share with you some of those results from last year. Let me talk a little bit about what we're seeing this year, then I'll show you some of the results from last year. We are still seeing alcohol and marijuana as our number one issue with drugs. Let me get all these clicking here. A lot of things broken. Prescription drug use, again, continues to grow. We talked about vape pens a little bit earlier. We see kids that are now starting to find ways of getting marijuana through wax and being able to use it in those vape pens. That's going to continue to be an issue. And so vape pens, I think, are something that schools are going to have to start talking about how to deal with on a regular basis. We're talking about it just in the community, I know, as well. You know, ecstasy, LSD, the psychedelics, as well as the other... you know, pill-based drugs are still a problem. And, again, not epidemic and not something that every young person is doing, but those kids who are using are putting themselves at really great risk, especially if they are using on campus or using, you know, getting from point A to point B. There has some cocaine. You know, cocaine has made a little bit of a resurgence in the state for young people. And then we were talking about things like salvia and spice. We don't see as many kids using salvia and spice, fortunately, because they're afraid of it. They actually understand the harms of those very dangerous drugs, salvia and spice being different, spice being the synthetic that we were talking about earlier. But there is some of that out there. And then finally, this graph, which you'll see, I can give you a cleaner copy of it, will show you that we are seeing good results with our counseling. So young people who report when they start counseling, very few times in the last 30 days where they did not smoke marijuana, after counseling, that number goes up a great deal, as well as those who report using almost daily use, they drop that use by the end of counseling, and that goes the same for alcohol. And other drugs, too. So we're really happy with what we're seeing with our counseling services, and that's a commitment that the school has made to let young people use their time on campus to seek counseling, get treatment, and so I applaud, you know, the district for that. It's been really great. And then finally, just kind of the same message, which is, you know, we really do believe that this district believes in evidence-based prevention, and that looks like three really clear things. First is that you have clear policies. You have good therapeutic counseling on campus. Counseling on campus lets, you know, students know that it's a real problem. It's not just a nuisance. It's not just a disciplinary issue. It's something that people need help with. But there should be meaningful consequences that go with that. You know, I preach this all the time about infiltration. If you have all staff wrapped around the same message, a young person's going to have a hard time on a campus getting a mixed message. If all staff on campus really believe in the message around the harms of alcohol or other drugs, options and alternatives for use, that's the kind of messaging that we'd like to see staff take on. And then finally, you know, curriculum. Curriculum matters in this. And if you can weave the discussion into your curriculum, it stops becoming such a unique, tokenized topic where it's only discussed in health and it's not discussed anywhere else. You know, we'll brainstorm with teachers all the time about how to use it in English. You know, talk about alcohol in English. You can't come up with a few dead poets. You're missing out on, you know, the alcohol discussion in your English curriculum or your math curriculum, social science, history. So we really do encourage schools to take a look at other ways of getting the message out. And that is the wrap of my report. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I'm sorry for some of the scatterness of the slides there.
Okay. First, I'd like to see if anyone from the public would like to address anything Frank discussed. Okay, I'll bring it back to the board.
I have a question.
Oh, I didn't see your light on.
Oh.
Okay, sorry.
Is there any thought being given to including texting cell phones within use within this, not just for driving, but also pedestrianing and things like that?
Yeah, the survey doesn't directly reflect whether you've been in the car and texted while you drove. We do a lot of that work through the Office of Traffic Safety, both San Luis High, Morro Bay High, as well as Laguna and Los Osos all have distracted driving programs through their Friday Night Live chapters where they get a lot of discussion around texting and driving and listening to music and generally not focused driving.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Buckman and Mr.
Thank you.
Roger.
Hi, Frank.
Sorry.
All the power in here. I think this tags on to Walter's question. somewhere in my memory, there's CHKS has more than just the section.
Yes, I'm only focused on the substance use section.
And
yeah.
So did this district participate in
bullying, meaningful relationships on campus?
Okay.
There's a lot of really good material in your report.
Okay.
About the way kids feel about being on campus.
Right.
Bullying has become a big topic. We have added some questions around parental perception of harm or parental. I'm drawing a blank right now. But parental perceptions is something we've added to your survey as well, because those are national measures that we're trying to trace. So the survey itself is somewhat adaptable. There's the core of it. Your district eliminated a couple questions. Other districts have added those questions. So there is some trying to balance it all out when we start getting them all in. But for the most part, we focus on those 30-day measures as our key indicators.
So, and just a real quick yes or no, is there a section that teachers, that sometimes we give to teachers on their feelings of what they see the kids doing? Was that part of CHKS?
I don't know about, Dana Francis is here.
The school climate.
And we have those
survey,
results as well?
Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much.
And we do some focus groups, too, where we'll go back out to a school and work with young people to say, what do you think, are these things real? And for the most part, they do.
Mrs. Roger.
Thank you. Mr. Warren, could you elaborate a little bit on the Medi-Cal reimbursable?
Yeah.
What types of services are you finding at PB that you're providing that are reimbursable? And then as an adjunct to that, could those be applied to the comprehensive high schools as well?
Yes. So we'll start with that question first. Yes. We have 9 school sites that last year became drug Medi-Cal certified across the county. In the first year of rolling out, we are doing those services at Del Rio Continuation, Pacific Beach Continuation, and now we're at the 3 community schools through the County Office of Ed. But we do have sites certified. We have Atascadero High is certified, but we're not doing services there. Roy Grandy High is certified, but we're yet to doing services there. So it's not just the continuations that can have the certification. And it's been very difficult to get those certifications, so I've slowly been working with your district on how to roll it out further to other schools. But back to your first question, which is a student needs to meet drug Medi-Cal criteria, they need to meet the diagnosis of addiction. And so that can look like severe abuse, to some. So the addiction bar is not as high as, what I think our general notion of what an addicted person is. So there's a lot of services that we've been providing in the past that would fall under the early intervention category, meaning a person who is a regular pot smoker, let's say, who is having a hard time getting to class, who finds their way to counseling. A lot of times we'll meet criteria for treatment because the use is more severe than what we sometimes label it as. And so that's a benefit of having these drug Medi-Cal reimbursable services on campus.
So treatment, what would treatment look like?
Treatment would look like more designated like cognitive behavioral therapy. So the sessions would become more focused on patterns of thinking and patterns of behavior, alternatives. Our therapists that are on campus do group processing as well as individual work in alternatives, coping, and then, of course, we're dealing with a lot of co-occurring issues. So some of our young people are also being able to be treated for maybe a depressive disorder as well as their substance use disorder, but we're able to do it right on campus.
Terrific.
Our mental health side has been doing this, for a long time. The drug Medi-Cal is new to our county.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else? All right, thank you very much. Thanks for coming.
A quick commercial for what's happening on Memorial Day.
Memorial Day weekend, 24th annual 24-hour relay challenge at San Luis High, and we're getting on it. So always looking for volunteers, slowfnl.com. You can find out the information. And I think I brought it in just under the 10 minutes Mr. Dowler gave me, so I'm pretty excited about my numbers tonight.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg.
Okay, next on the agenda is the teacher evaluation system. I guess we'll talk.
Good evening. I want to thank the following individuals for getting up here with me tonight to explain what we have been doing with our teacher evaluation system. Dean at San Luis High School, Aaron Black, and we have the interim vice principal at Morro Bay High School, Chris Jones, and we have Sarah Clough, elementary school teacher at Monarch Grove, and Scott Nairn, English teacher at San Luis High. And so we're here tonight to talk to you about the teacher evaluation system and the Danielson framework. And I think that we at San Luis Coastal are extremely lucky to have a system like this in place. Many districts don't have an instructional system that describes what good teaching looks like in the classroom. We have a system that we adopted from Charlotte Danielson's framework for teaching. And that system provides a common language so that when we are talking about teaching and learning, we all have the same framework and the same terminology and the same expectations across the district. And that it is consists of four different domains. And those domains, the first domain is planning and preparation. So that's everything that a teacher does before he or she gets in front of the students. The second domain is on classroom environment. And the classroom environment are all those rules and systems and expectations and that you set up in your classroom to have a productive environment for student learning. The third domain is instruction, so when the teacher's teaching in front of students. And the fourth domain is professional responsibilities. So those would be communicating with parents, attending professional development. So those are the four domains of Charlotte Danielson's work. And within those domains, there's these small subsets called components. So later you're going to hear about components, but components, there's multiple components underneath each one of those four major domains. And there's altogether, there are 22 different components. So that's kind of the basics for what we have and why we are so lucky to in San Luis Coastal to have this. So next, I'm going to have Scott get up and talk about the process, because he and I have been part of the, along with what, maybe 15 other people, have been part of the teacher evaluation system. Rick and Ryan were also part of that. And it's made up of a lot of teachers and some administrators, and I'm going to let Scott talk about that next. And Rose is also on it.
Rose, yeah. We have... So many, I was going to introduce, many of the committee members are actually here tonight. So starting into it, the goal was to have six teachers and six administrators. It ended up being a majority of teachers through the three-year process, and we're still meeting yearly. And so going into the process, I feel like the meetings were really productive, and I went into it not really enjoying the earlier evaluation system in which I, as a 15-year teacher at the time, would be satisfactory or unsatisfactory. I felt like there's a danger, and also, like, I want some constructive criticism, and so I think going into it, we were pretty open to, you know, something new that had different levels, and so we worked it out. It wasn't... there was disagreement, you know, I'd say, Rose, right? You know, and it was pretty intense. They were like tiring days, but I feel like we worked out a really good system that all the stakeholders are impressed with. So,
would add to it, change it slow.
I can answer more questions if you want. I was told to give two or three sentences.
Good evening. Just from my perspective, beginning at Morro Bay High School with the new process, as Scott mentioned, really took part in having more strength, positive conversations with teachers as an administrator. It was more of a collaboration process, a discussion between both as professionals, not just the checkbox pass-fail type of evaluation system that most California districts have been through, most of the ones that I've worked with. Scott and I have talked a number of times in the last year and a half at SLO High about this process. Both of us really enjoy it. We think it's very powerful and very excited for it. Teachers that I've worked with, they get to choose a couple areas, components that they would like to work toward. Professional development for themselves. They set goals throughout the year for themselves. Administrator gets to select two, and then there's a common component that's selected between both sides. And it's a very powerful process, much more effective than the past one. So I wanted to share that with you.
I wanted to add in on what Aaron and them have been doing that I think is really important with it is it's not a dinger system where if the teacher's doing something wrong, ding, you're it, you're a bad person. They've done a lot of really cool strategies, and one that I've seen Aaron and also Nick Frost and Leslie O'Connor, and I haven't seen Julie do it, but I understand she's doing it as well, is there's teachers that have had struggles with classroom management, and so they've been able to get a sub and go to five different classes that have good classroom management, and the administrator and the teacher go through that day looking at what other people are doing and then meet again at the end of the day and share what's going on with that. So it's opened these conversations up, but also there's some really good practices that have been like really helping teachers that, you know, are confused on what direction they need to take. So I found that to be pretty interesting and really kind of neat.
So next I asked Chris Jones because if he'd speak, because Chris and I started both a year ago, and or a year and a half ago, I guess it's been now, and so Chris joined us from Paso Robles, so I thought he would talk about what it's like to come into San Luis Coastal as a new administrator under the system.
Thank you. Along with that, I'd like to share how I see the Danielson framework as a valuable tool that establishes clear expectations and ensures accurate and meaningful evaluations, and allows teachers also to reflect on their teaching practices and not just receive a score of satisfactory or unsatisfactory. As Kristen explained, each of the four domains in the Danielson framework contains various components, and during observations, administrators collect data or evidence which transpires in the classroom during that observation, after which the administrator analyzes the data and assigns a performance level score of either unsatisfactory, basic, proficient, or distinguished for each of the components for which the teacher is being evaluated. This performance level score is based on the rubrics within the Danielson framework, and the rubrics contain critical attributes of each of the performance levels. Now, prior to coming to San Luis Coastal and being trained on the Danielson framework, I was often frustrated at the seemingly subjective and anecdotal nature of teacher evaluations. But with the framework as the centerpiece of our evaluation process, not only do teachers have a clear expectation of how to achieve a particular performance level, but teachers can examine the critical attributes of each performance level and reflect on their instructional practices. The rubrics for each one of the components also allow for honest and evidence-based discussions regarding teacher performances between the administrator and the teacher. Often when I meet with the teacher in a post-observation conference, I'll even ask the teacher to assess themselves based on the data I've collected and the Danielson rubric prior to sharing with them how I evaluated their performance. And in my experience, the majority of teachers accurately and fairly assess their classroom practices, given the clarity of the rubric and the Danielson framework. And then without prompting, which is kind of is very exciting, teachers often will then look at the next performance level, whether if they're at proficient, they'll look at the distinguished, and they'll make that their goal of reaching that level and analyze the critical components of that next performance level and make that their goal, with the ultimate goal of improving their instruction and increasing student learning. I find that this allows for more targeted observations and for further conversations in the next, you know, the follow-up visits that I make to teachers' classrooms.
So prior to starting evaluation, an administrator has to go through a whole series of assessments. We watched all sorts of videos. Every administrator in the district has done this. We watch all sorts of videos and have to score these videos, and it takes generally about 25 hours to watch all the videos and then go through. You're given two long exams. Each one is like 8 hours or something. I mean, it's just a long, long couple of days. And so all of us in the district have been trained and have passed the assessments in order to be able to evaluate teachers. So that's been a wonderful thing. So I'd like to show you actually what this looks like. So what you have up here is one of those rubrics. So we talked about how there were there was a rubric for each one of those components. Remember, there were 22 different components. This happens to be domain 3, which you can see at the top, which is the domain on instruction. And this is component 3C. This is what most of the schools have picked as their focus for the school for the year, because this is a real critical one in the Daniel framework. This is engaging students in learning. So how are students, when you go into the classroom, are they engaged? And then you can see on the left-hand side, it's broken down into different elements, things you're looking for in order to figure out if the students are engaged. So the first one on the left you can see up there is activities and assignments. Then you have grouping of students. Then you have instructional materials and resources. And then you have the one that I highlighted, structure and pacing. And I highlighted that for a reason, because you're going to get to see a little video on structure and pacing. But then you can see that as you go down the columns, the first column is unsatisfactory. So that is what you would see in the classroom if the teacher went unsatisfactory. So for structure and pacing, for example, the one that I've highlighted, if a teacher were unsatisfactory in that area, the lesson would have no clarity. No clearly defined structure, or the pace of the lesson was too slow, or rushed, or both. Sometimes it's rushed, sometimes it's slow. So that's what you would see if a teacher were unsatisfactory. If a teacher were basic, then you'd move across there and you'd see, you know, the lesson has a recognizable structure, although it's not uniformly maintained. You know, throughout the lesson, pacing of the lesson is kind of inconsistent. Where we want our teachers to be is at proficient. And so what you would see if you walked into a teacher's classroom that was where the structure and pacing was working well, the lesson would have a clearly defined structure around which the activities are organized, and pacing of the lesson would generally be appropriate. And that is where most of our teachers live most of the time, is proficient. Every once in a while you can strive to be distinguished, but it's really truly impossible to be distinguished in every area. It's very, very student-based. The students have to take on learning themselves. It's almost as if the teacher has created that environment, so if the teacher left, that environment would succeed without the teacher because the teacher has created this. So next I'm going to show you a video, and this video is Laura Storm, principal at Monarch Grove, which is Sarah's principal, and she is going to be giving feedback to a brand new teacher, Corey Berglund, who's a kindergarten teacher. And in this, they are talking about structure and pacing. It's only like 3 minutes long, but I wanted you to get an idea of what this looks like.
Get up, circle, come back. So that's a transition. Right. All right, yellow row, you know, you're looking really good, so go and go up there. And so I wanted to do that, but then I just add more transition time into it. So that's something I'm still working on in kindergarten, because I keep pretty tight leash, I guess. And I, again, let's do it again.
Right.
So
it sounds like,
I don't know,
all the different transitions maybe impacted pacing in a way you weren't expecting.
Yes.
Okay. So I went through and looked at that. And I pulled your lesson plan with your timestamp, and I pulled the scripting, and I compared.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the answer to your question.
Yeah, what happened?
So comparing to the actual timestamping, you'd plan to be done reviewing opinion and doing the hook for Would You Rather by 9:05, and that ended up being till 9:07. So you ended up 2 minutes behind there.
Yeah.
And then you'd wanted the purpose and the I do piece to last 10 minutes, but it was 14 minutes. So that's where you lost some of the 6 minutes.
Yeah, and that would have been great to have during the closure, because that's really when I needed more time to kind of like go around and listen to them sharing it.
So you can see the teacher recognized, you know, and by having the administrator there could realize why she was not able to do the closure at the end of the lesson was because she had missed those minutes because of her structure and pacing being off. But you can see it's a great dialogue where she's recognized something, and it's a great collegial conversation where she now is going to be able to focus on her structure and pacing in a way that she might not have recognized before. So this is where, now you see what the system looks like, and we're happy to answer questions. But before we do that, I asked Sarah, who's a veteran teacher. So Corey, who you just saw, is a brand new teacher. But Sarah is also at Monarch Grove, and she's a veteran teacher. So I've asked her if she would stand up and share her experience.
In recent years, our district has provided teachers with an incredible amount of professional development in the area of curriculum. The framework for teaching that we're talking about this evening has provided me with the instructional piece of the equation. Throughout this year, I've been able to work together and collaborate with my coach and principal in areas such as instructional strategies and techniques, academic structure and procedures to use with my students, and the use of a variety of highly effective tools and skills that benefit all teachers, not just those new to our profession, such as my friend Corey that you just saw, but for veterans such as myself. This framework for teaching has also provided me time for constructive reflection on observations of me teaching that are evidence-based, not subjective, but based on data gathered throughout multiple classroom visits by my principal throughout the year. As a teacher, I'm given a monumental task. With the support that's put in place with this framework and given by my administrator and my instructional coach, I can continue to build and provide a highly effective program in an environment that engages all of my students in their learning and development.
So, it's time for questions.
Well, first, I'd like to take it to the public, see if anyone would like to comment or have questions. All right. Back to the board. Anybody?
I just have a quick question on time stamping. Is that something that's unique to a new teacher when they're trying to get their rhythm going?
It's a strategy. So that teacher obviously was looking at the strategy of pacing and trying to figure out if her lesson was going to be on target. So when she had created her lesson plan, she had put down how long she thought everything was going to take. So 5 minutes for my intro and, 5 minutes for my closure. And so because she had said, I think my activities are going to take about this amount of time, and because she ended up short, she didn't get to the last part of her lesson. She never got to close the lesson and have the students really reflect on that learning. So that's what she had missed but the time stamping is a strategy that the principal had used to see if they were on target with their pacing. Good question, though.
Mr. Unger.
I was going to say I love the idea of the rubric and the training that everybody's getting. It's pretty labor intensive, but I know as someone who was doing evaluations before and looking at them in the best way that I could without a lot of structure, this seems like a much more accurate way of looking at how instruction is actually being delivered. And I like the idea of having it hopefully being able to look the same at Monarch as it does at Baywood, as it does here, as it does elsewhere. A question I have, though, is I had understood that it's pretty labor intensive, and that it from the administrative side, it's a lot of work, and that it was a lot of work last year. What have we done, and what changes are we seeing between this year and last year in terms of just the workload for the administrators and being able to get this done and share this in a way that's
I don't know
helpful.
That we've changed a lot about the workload for the administrators over the last at least year that I've been here. It is a really important task, and we want our administrators to all be on the same page and be speaking the same language and receive the same training. So I don't know that we have changed anything for the last year. Now, maybe we've changed something from 3 years ago, but I could ask, I guess, Aaron, if you, because you've been here more than...
Sure. The calibration process that we went through during the summer before, yes, that was a lot of work, took a lot of time, but a very, very important time. And I think most important this is the most important thing that we should be doing on campus every day. And so it is a process, and it's the thing that we need to be doing in the classrooms, working with teachers, developing that, you know, proficiency among all our staff. So I haven't seen much difference. If you have beginning teachers, brand new teachers, you have a little bit more to do compared to track two, the different tracks of the different teachers, track one, track two, or track three. But again, you know, it's the most important thing. It's what we should be doing. So I have not seen that big of a difference in the 2 years that we've been utilizing, or 3 years that we've been utilizing it. So,
I can jump in. Being part of the committee during those two times, we did actually go back with the group and change the number of components that teachers chose. So we made it smaller. We hopefully made it more manageable. So, to me, one of the greatest things about that group is that it's continued. And it continues to look at it on a yearly basis. We do staff surveys. We get input. And so annually, how can we, you know, make minor adjustments that make it easier? So that was one of the main things, was really narrowing the number of components so it wasn't so huge and they could focus in certain areas.
Thank you.
Is that what you were going to say, Rob? Yeah, we have worked on it as a committee. We did the survey, and that was one of the complaints. And that's the committee listened, and we adjusted the number of components that each one did. So we reduced some of the workload in that way. So thank you for mentioning that.
Thank you. And then a question for Kristen or somebody. I know that we all want our teachers to be proficient or distinguished, obviously, and you've talked about how difficult distinguished is and how there's no expectation, really, that people would be distinguished all the time. I think we know that. When we're getting teachers that are in an unsatisfactory or a basic mode or getting that kind of a scoring on this rubric, how are we helping them move toward proficient? And are we seeing that this has increased the movement for somebody who's unsatisfactory or proficient to move to proficient? So is this doing what we want it to do, which is move teachers into that proficient mm-hmm. level? And how do we know that?
So we have almost no teachers that are scoring in the unsatisfactory. I can't even think of a single rating that I've ever seen anyone be unsatisfactory. But, you know, teachers will, you'll have new teachers that are learning, and you'll have veteran teachers and, all, you know, a variety of teachers that will get basic in something that they, you know, have in one of the categories. We have very few teachers that are basic overall, you know, and their administrator provides more observations, more guidance, looks at what the issues are. We won't know whether those few teachers end up back into the regular track, but I'm thinking most of them are, because I did send an email to their administrators and they are keeping me abreast of what they're doing and working with the teachers more closely than they would, kind of more in line with what they would be doing with the first and second year teachers, just working with them more frequently, more individualized.
Thank you.
Mrs. Rogers and Mr. Quesenberry.
Thank you. I like what I'm seeing of this evaluation instrument, and I especially like that it was collaboratively constructed. But my question I'm having, I'm not sure exactly if I can articulate it well, but the teacher's ability to demonstrate proficiency, I think, is often largely affected by the composition of their class. If you have a difficult class in a given year and you're being evaluated repeatedly and you have disruptive kids, or I'm wondering how an evaluator, what kind of slack or maybe advice an evaluator would give to a teacher who is struggling with a particularly difficult class in a given year?
Well, if I were evaluating a teacher that was struggling, I would probably be focusing on domain two, which is classroom environment, because that is where you're setting out all the structures, the rules, the behavioral expectations, the climate of the classroom. And so oftentimes if you have a group of students that are not very well behaved, oftentimes you can go back to deficiencies in the practice in the area of domain two. I don't know that it's always connected to the students as much as it is connected to the practice. But I will let our expert teachers, if you guys would like to add anything, or any of our administrators.
Domain one also talks about those areas in domain that talks about the composition of your class. And what's really important within the rubric is that should not be an issue. The composition of the students should not be an issue in a teacher's evaluation. Otherwise, we would be setting ourselves with a very unfair evaluation instrument,
right.
And it is not unfair. But part of what that domain one is recognizing the students you have in your class, your number of ELs, your behavioral issues, students who might be on the autism spectrum that is mainstream in a class that will certainly affect the classroom environment. But it's the teachers that we're observing, it's teacher behavior that's being observed within the context of a classroom. And the student issues, while they certainly impact the class, should not impact the way a teacher is responding to those appropriately or inappropriately that can be measured based on evidence. So it's not, so it should, the Danielson model shouldn't be construed to be something that's kind of relevant depending on the type of class you get. It really is about observable behaviors of a teacher, not of students. And I think that there's certain domains within that the framework that address those issues. And part of the pre-conferencing that you would have with your principal before an observation is, hey, look, this is my class, and you know I have these three boys here, and you know these are the strategies I'm going to use. This is how I'm working with that, but no, something could happen here. And that's part of understanding the teacher's world and the administrator's use of evidence to evaluate that teacher. So I don't think it's – I don't – correct me if anyone thinks I'm wrong that was on the committee, but I don't think it's connected with that. Amy's on our committee.
Great conversation. I was on the committee as well, and the only thing I would add to what Rick is saying is that when there's trust – between administrator and teacher, having the administrator come in to see what you're trying with what might be difficult or challenging children, you've now got a partner in there to give you some feedback, try some ideas, send you to get some help. So I think even more so, I'm trying to remember who asked the question, Marilyn, the administrator can be that person to get you the assistance you need.
Okay. Thank you all.
I would just add that if you look at the distinguished category, a lot of it is student-centered, student-driven, and that's a question I get from a lot of teachers who want to be distinguished. And, you know, we talk about how do you, for lack of a better term, train the students. For example, in the area of class discussion and questioning, if you're going to be distinguished, it's going to be because a lot of discussion is driven by the students and the teacher is more of that moderator. That's something that's taught over time, and that's explicitly taught to the students. So a lot of discussions I have with teachers who want to move from that proficient to distinguished in that particular area, I talk about how do you explicitly teach the skills so that it is student-centered and student-driven.
Mr. Quesenberry, then Mr. Unger.
Thank you.
So I just want to clarify some things. First, not every teacher is getting evaluated every year.
That's correct.
Could you kind of give us an overall idea of who gets evaluated, when, and how often?
Sure. So a teacher is a Track 1 teacher for 2 years. So the first 2 years, regardless of whether they're a temporary or a probationary employee, they, for 2 years, are getting evaluated for the first year and the second year. And within that, what that Track 1 teacher's schedule will look like is they receive two informal evaluations where they come in and observe without telling the teacher they're coming in advance. And then two, formal evaluations where they sit down in advance of the lesson, they learn what the teacher's going to be teaching and what the, you know, what the dynamics of the classroom are all about, and have a discussion with them, and then come observe and then give a written feedback afterwards. So they get two informals and two formals before their mid-year on December 15th. Then they get two more informals and two more formals before their final at the end of the year. So that's a lot of work for a Track 1 teacher. Two informals, two formals, a mid-year, two informals, two formals, and a final. That's a Track 1 teacher. And so you do Track 1 for the first year, and then you repeat it and do Track 1 for the second year. And usually those are teachers that we're going to decide, are we going to tenure those teachers? So you've now observed those teachers 16 times and had multiple conversations with them, so it really helps to firm your decision of whether that is a teacher that should gain tenure in our district. Then a teacher becomes a Track 2 teacher, and Track 2 teachers go from a self-directed year where they set goals, and there are goals that they work through with their administrator, and they work on the goals all year long, and then at the end of the year they review the goals. It's not formal, it's just a year where they are doing a lot of professional growth or trying to strive towards something. And then they have a formal Track 2 year. And that is really what the majority of our teachers who are not in their first 2 years, almost everybody else is a Track 2 teacher. Either they're being self-directed, where they're just setting goals. Those are the years that we would say they're not being evaluated. And then they're formally being evaluated. And a typical teacher will go back and forth. 1 year they'll be self-directed. The next year they'll be formally evaluated. Then they'll do a self-directed year, and then they'll be formally evaluated. Those teachers where an administrator has some concerns and would like to work further with the teacher, might choose to have them be formal every single year for multiple years. So it's certainly the administrator's decision to say, I don't really want to put you on self-directed this year because we're doing really good work together, and I really feel like I'd like to watch you and observe you more. And that what that looks like is they have two informals, two formals, and a final. So it's half the amount that a Track 1 teacher would receive. And then teachers who have a majority of basics overall would become Track 3 teachers. We have very few Track 3 teachers, but they work intimately with their administrators, and they have lots of evaluations, and it's very personalized. It depends on what they got the basics in. They might just choose to work on those areas. Most of them are just choosing to work on the areas in which they received a basic to become proficient, and most of those Track 3 teachers are going back into Track 2. This is the first year we've had Track 3 teachers, and as I said, I've kept space with the administrators, and those teachers are doing very well because I think they've gotten that extra, you know, discussion time, and also there have been the rubrics and the clear expectations that we have a great system.
So just for my clarification, a teacher would get, if they have permanent status, they would be, and they're considered Track 2, they would have a formal evaluation every other year.
Typically. You could. There is something in the contract that allows for 2 years of not being evaluated, okay. And so administrators are often doing the two-year thing. But because the system was so new, most administrators were choosing to do the every other year thing because they wanted every teacher to experience it. So there was a common dialogue, a common conversation. So most administrators were wanting to do an every other year thing, but in the contract they can go 2 years without being evaluated.
And as far as the narrowing, you know, I have a couple of questions. You know, you have the four categories, and you have the 22 components. So an administrator going in and the teacher are looking at what their focus is going to be. They're going to narrow that focus, or is there a general focus decided upon every year or every other year?
So the Track 1 teachers have 8 components that they
okay.
look at. Chosen by the administrator, and the Track 2 teachers have 2 that are chosen by the administrator, 2 by the teacher, and 1 that's mutual. They have a total of 5.
Great. Now, have we found that there's, as you look at some of these components, there's a kind of a nexus or a synergy that if you focus on certain ones, mm-hmm. it will somehow positively affect the other components?
Yes, I know those that have been administrating, doing a lot of administration, have created nexuses. I don't know if I know Leslie was talking the other day about classroom management being very closely connected to student engagement. But yes, I know the administrators have found that a lot more. Because, do you want to speak to that? There, Leslie's here. He was...
Good evening. I apologize. I don't have any notes with me. So the great question, Jim, about the Nexus, we found from our data over the last 3 years that the Nexus really came around 3C, that student engagement piece, but also, and again, I may get the letters and the numbers mixed up, so I apologize, but 3D, the question and discussion techniques, but 3B, I'm hearing, and then we link it back to domain two and the culture of learning in the classroom. So you really saw that as a sweet spot. Student engagement, discussion and questioning technique, and then the culture of learning. Cultural learning was more back in domain two, while these other two were in domain three. And then the final piece was your assessment of the learning, which I believe was maybe 3D or 3E. And between those four areas, we started to see some real data that we could talk with our staff about. And I would commend personnel at the end of last year. They basically went through and they tabulated up all of the scores for all of the teachers by each school site in each of the domains and each of the components. And they shared that out with us at the summer debriefing. And we were able to see certain patterns not only for our own school, but we were able to have comparative data from other schools. So we were able to sit as secondary schools, the two high schools, the two middle schools, and then we were able to compare that data with the elementary schools. And we could start to see for the first time as administrators what were we focusing in on. And organically, as an administrative team, we were all focusing in on the same things, which is really quite interesting. And then we could start to disaggregate that data and say, well, how is it that your 15 teachers that you evaluated on 3B were all proficient? What were those key components that you saw that made them that? So we're becoming a lot more used to the system.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Chris.
Yeah, last question I have is, so we've got this great rubric and we've got these really well-trained administrators that are being able to differentiate between the four levels. And how do the teachers know before the administrator comes in what distinguished versus proficient looks like or basic versus proficient looks like? So I'm imagining they're not watching 25 hours worth of videos, but yet, in all fairness, a teacher should know what it looks like so they can have a fair expectation of what it looks like now, what to achieve for.
The rubric is a short novel, you know, and when you look through it, the biggest problem that, with my union hat on for a second, the biggest problem the teachers had with it is they all want to be distinguished in everything. It's a four-point rubric. We should be getting fours. And so the learning curve was the fact that proficient is really good and distinguished is something that you're not going to be able to do across the board. So there's a bit of a learning curve of that. When you look at the rubric, it informs you. I feel like you could just check it out, and I often look at it when I'm being evaluated, and it's very instructive. These are the parts that can get you distinguished. These are the parts that you think you can do with the class that you have. You know, these are the parts that are causing you to fail. So I think it's really well written, and there's a lot of information. And if a teacher took the time to look at it, it's very instructive. So I would say that the rubric is our teaching tool, and it's really well written. So,
anyone else? I would just add that I think the collaborative nature of this, seeing the teachers and administrators having worked together and trained together and discussed this, is very encouraging. It provides an opportunity to strengthen the school culture and build trust, and those are kids respond to that. So thank you very much. Right. So now we will have public comment. And if there's anyone here wishing to address the board on an item not on the agenda, now's your time. We have each person is given 3 minutes in which to speak. I know Mrs. Roger has some yellow sheets. If you have, anyone with the yellow sheet we need, please. All right, so let's see. So do you want to, I'm having a lot of trouble tonight.
Okay, first I have Rose Fowler, followed by Heidi Harmon.
I'm Rose Fowler, talking as a citizen at this point. Back in the late 80s, when I bought my home near the Marigold Center, French Park, Islay Park, all that out there, they told us that the train track is really close, but we only have passenger trains going through here once or twice a day. So it seemed okay. We're in a flood zone. We were on an earthquake fault. There were all these things that they told us about our home, but we decided, okay, we're going to purchase it anyway. It's a beautiful area, lots of homes, kid-oriented, a lot of family-oriented there, so it was a great place to raise children. Recently, I'd been approached by someone that told me about the rail spur in Napomo that's trying to come through. And they were from Oakland. It's like, well, why are you talking to me? I don't quite understand how I'm concerned about Oakland or Napomo. And then they pointed out that the railroad tracks go through my backyard and near Los Ranchos School, where I worked for 10 years. And I got to thinking about what I had been told when I purchased my home, and I thought, that's not right. I need to say something. There are million-dollar homes around the tracks in my neighborhood, also near the country club where Los Ranchos School is. I know when we were there, the trains that would come through, they started to put freight trains through. The trains do rumble through there. Instruction does have to stop at times because of the noise that goes through there. And the earth does shake. The kids have a thing where if they're out at recess, they pick their feet up. They'll hang on the bars. They'll put their feet. If they're in the classroom, they sit down and put their feet up as the trains go by. I'm not quite sure the purpose of that, but that was something that they do, and their alma mater song refers to the trains in it. So it's a part of life there, but when I heard about the possibility of the derailments and the explosions and crashes, that really concerned me, so I thought I would come to the board and talk about that. Besides that, I mean, that might be an exceptional case, but just the noise and the odor with our kids there near the tracks at Los Ranchos, the asthma concerns that I have asthma myself, those all brought me to the board to talk about it. And I'm seeing more of it in the newspaper as a concern. I don't know what the time frame is on it. The people that speak behind me have more of the details, but I just wanted to share from a citizen point of view how that would impact my neighborhood, my friends, my neighbors, the students that we work with, and I really believe it's a school safety issue as we have so many schools near the tracks. That would impact a lot of students. If there were an explosion, I'm not sure we would have the facilities to deal with it here because the facilities to deal with it are also near the tracks. So I'm asking that we put this on a consent agenda for the school board so we can talk about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, board, and thank you for your time. My name is Heidi Harmon, and I'm here to talk about the proposed rail spur project. I'm just going to give you a few facts and some information so that you have it. And again, we're asking you to put this on your consent calendar to write a letter of opposition to the Planning Commission and to the Board of Supervisors. This project would increase the volume of oil trains many-fold, bringing in at least 5 1-mile to 1.5-mile long trains every week for the foreseeable future, thereby increasing the risk of spills and derailments significantly. Approximately 2.5 million gallons of toxic tar sands crude would be traveling by rail through San Luis Obispo every day. This would also cause major traffic issues at all railroad crossings. There are a limited number of oil trains currently traveling through California cities on the Union Pacific line. The majority of towns along this route do not have oil trains or have a very small amount. We have, I think, currently 1 to 2 per week here in San Luis Obispo. The oil that Phillips 66 wants to import is different than the oil that is currently coming from San Ardo, California. This is a much more toxic and corrosive tar sands diluted with explosive chemicals. This type of extreme crude dramatically elevates our risk. The San Luis Obispo County Environmental Impact Report admits that this project would have a significant and unavoidable risk of rail accidents and hazards. Our current rail system was not built to move large quantities of hazardous materials like this crude oil. These old and outdated and unsafe tank cars were built to the standards of the 1970s and were built to transport corn syrup and the like, but not hazardous materials. There is no safe way to transport hazardous crude by rail. Even the newer tank cars have been involved in major derailments and fires and explosions. If this project were to be approved, it is not a question of if an accident will occur, but when. There are major threats to student safety. There are five San Luis Obispo schools within a half mile of the rail, and this is called the transportation evacuation zone, for which we have no real way of dealing with if there is a major derailment. And as you probably know, school employees are state-mandated disaster workers while on the job, and they are not equipped to deal with the dangers posed by this project. So we strongly encourage you to join with other school districts and write a letter of opposition. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Elizabeth Keene, followed by Amy Higgins.
Hi, thank you. My name is Elizabeth Keene, and I'm from Oakland, California. I'm a grandmother of two school-age girls. Why did I come here so far? I came here to make sure that you were aware that school boards along the oil train corridor are starting to come out in opposition to the Phillips 66 oil spill project, out of concerns for their schools near the tracks, especially and for issues like childhood asthma. To your south, both Ventura and Pleasant Valley have written letters opposing the project. To the north, besides Oakland, both San Leandro and Berkeley have opposed it. Hopefully, your district will be the first school board in the county here to address this issue. In your packet, there is, besides the project, I put in the OUSD letter, and also has the list of all the schools that are within a mile of the track, both in your count, both in your district and the other districts in the county. Your area is about 3,000 students, and there's looks like there's similar numbers in the other districts. Again, we hope you will have a further discussion on this and vote on this. It would be very helpful. But besides that, I also wanted to make five general points about the oil train projects that maybe you haven't heard so far. First of all, that the oil trains will decrease property values along the rail corridor in here and in our area for houses that are close to the tracks. Secondly, the oil train projects will increase the tax burden in your county because you all are responsible for paying for both the emergency preparedness, which is, as you know, very, very expensive for schools, and also in case the worst case scenario, if there is an accident, an explosion, fire, that the county will have to pay for the emergency response to the accidents, not insignificant area. Thirdly, train accidents do happen in San Luis Obispo County, as you all are aware. Just so far, there has not been an oil train accident. And lastly, Phillips 66, like the other Fortune 500 oil companies, are looking to, they're increasingly exporting their refined fuels to other countries, especially Asia, because of their increased profit margin of selling oil overseas as opposed to selling it in the United States. Thank you very much for your attention. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Amy Higgins, and I'm coming to you as a mother of a first grader. And I just want to say that I'm proud to say that I attended kinder through 12 with this district, so I'm actually very proud to be able to raise my daughter here. Sorry, I'm a little nervous. My main concern right now is that my daughter for both kinder and first has been in very impacted classrooms. So 26, 27 in kinder, no support. And now she's in a first grade class with 30. Great teachers, but with 36-year-olds, there's only so much that one adult can do. And I understand that there's budget constraints. I understand we all can't have 20 kids in our classroom. But what I would strongly consider our request is that if you could at least consider some additional resources be put for these teachers, whether it's an aid for particular, you know, that exceed 25 kids. I think that our kids are suffering for it. There's a lot of time being spent on classroom management and just trying to deal with a lot of the behavioral issues, and I feel like my daughter's kind of being shortchanged right now. And like I said, I'm really proud to raise my daughter in this area, but I feel like there's more that can be done. So if we could strongly look at the class size, and not just making tiny classrooms, but if that's not an option, getting creative with aids or other push-in support rather than just push out support. Thank you for your time.
Quick question.
Yes.
What school are you
at? I'm here at Monarch Grove right now.
Okay.
Thank you.
Jennifer Lurt-Wakara, I'm sorry.
So close.
And Becky Wells.
Lurt-Wachara. My husband is Thai. I'm not. I'm also talking about the same issue. I have a first grader now at Baywood School in Los Osos, and his kindergarten class had 27 children in it. There were two 27 child kindergarten classes with only one teacher. And as a result, I feel my first grader has had to learn how to love school his first grade year and not his kindergarten year. I had to deal a lot with him wanting to come home early. It was... And I'm coming from the perspective of a mom who was there every week. I was in my first son's kindergarten classroom. He had 25 students, same teacher, Mrs. Fay, who is fabulous, I think top 5% of kindergarten teachers of the universe. And I was there weekly helping with their literacy, with their writing in their journals. Wow, what a progression I saw the year my first child went through kindergarten with Mrs. Fay. It was still the half-day program, but she had two aides in the classroom with her. Huge difference 3 years later to my second child, who had Mrs. Fay, 27 kids, full-day kindergarten program, no aides. I did not see that consistent, because I worked with their journaling. So you can see from the beginning to the end, and when you're there every week, it's great because you can really see progress. And by the end of my first son's year, where Mrs. Fay had support, she had two aides in there, across the board, progress. The year that my son went through, which was last year, it was just scattered. You could see kids all over the place as far as, and this is anecdotal. This is just me. This is just seeing this. My concern is I have a third son coming up in 2 years, and I feel like it's Russian roulette. I don't know what the rules are about what class size is for kindergarten. I don't know. I want him to have a year like my first grade kid had, which was a teacher, two aides, 25 students in the class. I went to Mrs. Fay's, I do a Chinese New Year presentation. I'm not Chinese either, but for kindergarten, and I went to Mrs. Fay's class this year. She has 20 students. It was like a miracle classroom. It was beautiful. And the demographic didn't change. There's still, at Baywood, we have a huge variety of kids coming into kindergarten. And just a reminder that, you know, K through 3 is where we should really, really have tiny class sizes. It's an urban myth, the whole third grade and city planning, that's how they plan prisons, you know, by third grade literacy rates. But there are definitely parallels regarding third grade reading and if you finish high school. And then if you finish high school, how likely you are to be in prison. So I really hope that our resources are focused on that and that principals have clear guidelines about how big kindergarten classes should be.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi there. I'm Becky Wells. I have a first grader also at Monarch Grove, and this is our third year being at Monarch Grove. We've had great teachers. We have been there since TK. I've been an active volunteer in the classroom. I'm here to ask for assistance for our teachers. We have one teacher with 29 to 30 kids. I'm there every day. I volunteer at least once a week. I pick up my child. I take my child to school. The teachers are spending a large amount of their time managing the classroom. not effectively teaching because they have to manage. There's no support. The children are not engaged like they should be because they're managing behavioral issues as well, because we have quite a few, actually. You can imagine 5 to 7-year-olds. They don't want to sit all day long. So it makes it really hard for the teachers to teach a Common Core effectively. It makes it really hard for the student to learn effectively, you know, when you're not engaged. So I don't want to see this happen next year for our second graders or for any primary grades. They really are important. It sets the bar. It sets our foundation for school and how they feel about it. You know, so I'm pretty passionate about it. So I'm here to respectfully request assistance for our teachers, for our kids to be engaged, and to love to go to school. My child loved to go to school. And in first grade, it's tough. And there's one teacher and 30 kids. That's it. So it makes it really hard on everyone. And I just really am here to respectfully request that you develop and execute a plan for next year where our teachers can have more assistance and pull in support so our kids are engaged and love school, so they love life. Thank you for listening.
I believe that's all the yellow slips we have. Is there anyone else who wishes to address the board at this time? All right. I see that I skipped over correspondence, and I would point out that the board, I believe, received a couple of emails this week with regard to class size and an email with regard to testing. Is there anyone else who wants to has correspondence to report? Okay. So next we're into the superintendent updates. And first is business and budget. Mr. Pinkerton.
Yeah, so we have rolled the budget, beginning budget development for next year. PO cutoff was Friday. I reminded everybody Monday morning. All the principals love that email from me. But the only other thing that I would talk about, touch base with, is that Amy, Kim, Julie, Diane, Rick, you know, putting together the LCAP, tying it into the budget. A lot of work is being done right now to do all those things. We had another great meeting with the County Office of Education yesterday to discuss some of the nuances now and what the state's looking for and how, you know, specific items and how they have to be worded, especially talking about data and student achievement, those types of things. So though tough at times to have the conversation, I think it was a fruitful meeting for us, and so it's going to help us as we begin to put the fine tune on our LCAP, which the board will receive soon.
Thank you. Anyone from the public wishing to speak to this? Any questions from the board? All right, moving on, educational services update, Mr. Robinette.
For tonight, and the fact that I'm going to be in front of you for a few items, I'll defer the Ed Services update unless you have any questions for me.
Any questions from the public? Any questions from the board? So we will see you later. Measure D update, Mr. Pinkerton.
Yeah, I feel like we had a great study session again. I mean, there's just so much conversation, so much to talk about when it comes to Measure D and these initial phases as we get started. So it was great. We have an item later on the agenda to touch base about that. And then lastly, our next board study session will be the 22nd. Kim did put out the Google Doc to the board members for questions that you may have so that we can make sure that we answer those. And the focus of the next meeting will really be more of an in-depth look at projects and priorities at both Slo High and Morro Bay High School.
Thank you. Anyone from the public? Mr. Quisenberry.
Are we returning to the morning time?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. That's the plan.
All right.
9 a.m.
Thank you. All right. We're moving on to our discussion items, and the first is 8.01 counseling model update and review. Mr. Dowler.
Hi. How's it going? Should I move that? Okay. Yeah.
Good evening. Mr. Prater asked me a while ago to give a presentation to the board with an update on our district's counseling programs. The goal of my presentation is to give a snapshot of what our school counselors do, not the entirety, just a snapshot. These programs are much more comprehensive than presented here tonight, but I believe this is a good but brief validation of their work. Look at that technology. At the beginning of the year, I worked with site administration to create goals for their counselors. This slide shows the three goals presented to each counseling group. Number one, clarity, refers to promoting a clear understanding of what counselors do and how they can do it. Number two, articulation, relates to our ability to explain and demonstrate the impact of counseling programs. And number three, efficiency, represents our desire to improve how counselors use tools to improve their impact on students. There have been accomplishments in each of these areas, but they are still a work in progress and will continue to be. I'm going to break up the next group of slides in by grade level and school level. So starting with elementary schools, for goal one, clarity, the elementary counselors work collaboratively to revise their job descriptions. This is a brief quote from the revision, which everyone thought summarized their role perfectly. Elementary counselors provide a full range of professional student services, including group and individual counseling activities to assist children in their development of academic and social skills. For articulation, this slide shows the number of students supported by elementary counselors from August to April of this year. I'd like to point out that they have worked supporting over 1,000 students this year district-wide. 600 of these students were given individual or group support by a specific counselor, and 70% of these students were socioeconomically disadvantaged. So this data begins to show the efficacy and the impact of school counselors in our schools. In the area of efficiency, elementary counselors are recording and tracking data on student service in a uniform manner. This allows them to not only analyze the data, but communicate with site administration as well with other sites when students change schools. Now I would like to ask Maribel Chavez to come speak more about the program she runs at Baywood Elementary and Pacheco Elementary Schools.
Okay, well, thank you for this opportunity to come and share a little bit about elementary school counseling and what we do to support our students, our family, and our staff. The elementary years are a time when students begin to develop their academic self-concept, their feelings of competence and confidence as learners. They are beginning to develop decision-making, communication, and life skills, as well as character values. So the knowledge, attitudes, and skills that students acquire in these areas of academic and personal social development during these years serve as a foundation for future success. And school counselors, like myself, are here to support our future leaders in this process. So as Mr. Dowler said, you know, I'd like to share just a snapshot of what we do. And as school counselors, we have quite a variety of responsibilities and duties that, you know, sometimes can be endless to name. So I'd like to name a few in four different categories here. The first one being school guidance curriculum. A key component of my program, and I know that of programs in our district, would be to implement the second step, which is a research-based program teaching skills for academic and social success. It includes units in skills for learning, empathy, emotion management, and problem solving. This is a fantastic program that I have at all at the two elementary levels or schools where I work, and it also includes preschool, so that's one of my favorite parts of my job. You will often also see us doing guidance lessons in our classrooms. I love to include literature to promote character education and to address needs in the classrooms as well. So being in the classroom is one of my favorite things to do, and it also gives me that opportunity to work with all students, not just with a certain particular group. Moving on to our academic support. In the area of academic support, we teach our students skills for learning, as mentioned previously, goal setting, understanding their own strengths and weaknesses, and we can do this through individual, small groups, or also as a whole class. So we don't spend a ton of time in the academic area, but it is something that we do very often. Now,
in the responsive services, this is where we devote most of our time, and that's with individual and small group counseling. In this area, we get to serve students with a variety of needs, many, many different needs. And what's unique about elementary school is that we get to do a lot of small groups, whereas that is not as often happening at the secondary level. They deal a lot with, you know, more academics and individual students. So we facilitate groups in areas such as friendship skills, divorce, or banana split, self-esteem, other social skills, and again, depending on the needs of each of our schools. So that's something that I do every day at both of my sites. Now, another component of this category would be the individual, family, and school crisis intervention. And this is an area where I feel like you never know what's going to happen when you come to school that day. There could be a crisis, whether it be an individual having a crisis in the classroom, or that could be a family crisis, you know, death in the family, homelessness. So quite a variety of things that we get pulled for. Being part of the crisis team, you know, you could even be called on a weekend. So we must be ready at any moment to respond. Consultation and collaboration, that's huge, huge, huge. We are part of a team, so we work a lot with parents, with teachers, administration, community agencies, and that's all done sometimes informally in the halls, recess, anytime a teacher can catch us, or also formally, of course, in meetings. We have been very fortunate to have MFTs at our sites, also collaborating with us, so there's a lot of collaboration there, consultation, because they're working with our most at-risk students, and so that's a fabulous part. Referrals. We make a ton of referrals to outside agencies, and I'm glad that we work very closely with our family advocates and our resource coordinator, often in contact with them, whether it be by email, phone calls, meetings, to make sure that our families are accessing the services that they need. And it's such an important component. And over to system support. Again, consultation, collaboration, and lots of teaming. For example, several of us are the SST coordinators at our sites. If not, we're definitely participants. And so speaking of coordinating, at my site and at our sites, we support our school programs and events that are promoting positive school climate and parent education. For example, attending ELAC meetings, Latino Family Literacy Project, bringing presenters to our schools. Several of us also have some form of like peace patrol or conflict manager or other peacekeeping programs at our sites that we coordinate, and we make sure that they're working at our sites as well. So to kind of bring it to closure, I'd just like to go over again that elementary school years set that tone for developing the knowledge, attitudes, and skills necessary to become healthy, competent, and confident learners. Through a comprehensive developmental school counseling program, school counselors work as a team with the school staff, parents, and community to create a caring climate and atmosphere. So thank you.
Thanks, Maribel. In our middle schools, our secondary counselors rewrote their job descriptions this year as well. This is a brief quote, but I think it summarizes our role very well. Secondary counselors promote student success, provide preventative services, and respond to identified student needs by implementing a school counseling program addressing academics, career planning, and personal social development for all students. In the case of middle school counselors, they do these things with an emphasis on helping students transition, obviously, between the elementary and high school levels. For the articulation portion of the goal, this slide shows the numbers and scope of the impact in our middle schools that middle school counselors have had. They've worked with over 688 students so far this year. 49%, almost 50% of these students are socioeconomic disadvantaged, so that's a very heavy impact in a target population. 136 of these students were targeted for at-risk student supports, and there's a program to target these students and support them. I want to point out part of that is referring students, 94 students to on-campus therapeutic programs, as well as 109 students to family advocates in our middle schools this year. So that's a lot of work. In the area of efficiency, a big emphasis at this level has been implementing the student assistance program that Frank referred to earlier today. It's a model, program model in partnership with County Behavioral Health. This model integrates the use of school staff with a family advocate, a Friday night live coordinator, and a therapist from County Behavioral Health. The goal is to use a team-based approach to support students and their families. And Scott Scaldi is here from Laguna Middle School to talk about his work as an administrator working in this program this year.
There we go. So speaking really on behalf of just Laguna for myself and Mr. Colando and our school site, I didn't really consult with LOMS here. Our host. But this is what we see. The difference for us is the SAP program this year, and along with that are bi-loopy meetings. So we meet every 2 weeks with our team, Mr. Colando and I, our counselors, and the rest of the SAP team. And we kind of have an RTI sheet, and we basically look at as many factors as we can. We have an academic factor, a counseling factor, a fit factor if a kid is in family in transition, socioeconomic factor, a counseling factor, are they seeking counseling? And we basically come up with a total risk number. Where is this kid? And we really have our highest kid. And then we look across the board and say, these are our different interventions, and we also have other. What are we doing for this child? Whatever their need is. And it's really, really important to do that in the fall. This time of the year, we're checking in. How are we doing with that student? Are they making progress? Where are we? Who's new coming on our radar? Especially at this point, grades are pretty, we've got that under control, but it's if households are having issues and that student is acting out or we're having something. So the bi-weekly meetings with our counselors and with our new team have been great. As I go down to the next thing, we did realize that capacity building is part of this process. Bringing new people onto our team is wonderful, but it takes some time. They don't know which classrooms are okay to pull kids out of and which ones aren't, which teacher's going to complain. There are so many nuances to how schools kind of work that it takes a little while to train them. And the people who really train them are our counselors. Mr. Klenner and I do not. So we realize that, and we're at the point in this school year where, yeah, we're doing really good. Hopefully our same team stays together for next year, and we won't have to rebuild much of that capacity, if any at all. Consistency is really important. We all get busy, and those meetings need to happen. And we need to stay committed to them. And lastly, our counselors are pretty darn efficient. When we pull out the numbers, and I realized that as of last week when I pulled this data, they had 1,846 log entries. That means that's 12.3 kids per day, and that's conservative because I realized that our counselors only work 7 extra days, not 10. So I just took the total number and divided it by 150 because at this time we'd had 140 school days, and I threw in 10 extra days. So it's a little higher than that. 53% of the time, they're talking to kids about school, about grades. Oftentimes, it's a lot of those low socioeconomic kids, and it's organization. It's what are you doing? What are the strategies? Do you have a planner? Are you checking the website? Do you have internet? Do you have PowerSchool? Contacting the families and making sure they're in the loop. We do see that 25% of the time, they're helping a kid with a personal issue. And then, of course, down at the bottom, it's kind of that number's big to me, that 11% of the time they're making a resource referral. That's 1 out of 10 kids, or 1 out of 10 log entries, I guess. It's just a lot. Anyway, this is the snapshot of Laguna. We like this year's model. We realize that it takes work to make it succeed, and we realize that our counselors are pretty efficient. Thank you.
I'd like to add that the integration of the therapists at all levels is really a collaboration project, and it has stumbling blocks sometimes, but it's something that I think we've been refining throughout the year. So I'm really optimistic about the results, which are the profound impact that it's having on students and families. At the high schools, high school counselors also worked on their job descriptions with middle school counselors, so this is the exact same, but their focus is on preparing students for college and career post-secondary life. In articulation, I found it particularly impressive that this year our high school counselors have individually seen almost 2,000 students. Those are individual appointments. It's not group appointments. It's individual appointments. That's a lot of individual student attention. Over 450 of these students were specifically targeted for at-risk supports. In the areas of efficiency, streamlining job duties, because of their individual attention to students, streamlining job duties has been a very large task. So to support this, we have invested in a computer program called Naviance. I'm sure some of you have heard of that. Elena will speak about that here in a bit. But the goal is to help counselors work with students for course, college, and career planning. Elena Smith is here, a counselor at Morro Bay High School, to talk about how high school counselors are implementing Naviance and also how they target and support at-risk students.
Well, good evening. I'll talk about Naviance first, since that's what's listed there as the first topic. And Naviance, I'm going to speak for myself and everyone, all the other counselors too, but I love it. It's an exciting program. We first launched it, well, we've been in training since the beginning of the school year and have been talking about it since last spring. This past January, February, started to put the program together, and we decided let's implement it. So we used our sample group, our AVID classes at Morro Bay High School and at San Luis High, and we did our classroom presentations by introducing Naviance, and it was a chance for us to work through the glitches and get feedback specifically from the students as to what was working and what was not working. So how does Naviance work? What does it entail? And it has a course section where the student can pick an educational plan for diplomacy, and then also another plan for the A through G CSU UC requirements. So the student can pick either or, they can do both. And from that information, it lets the student know whether they're on track for those goals. The other component is the college component, and you can do college super match or a college match, and you can pick a university by different tabs that it has on there as according to location, size, cost, major, etc. And there's about 20 of them on there, for example. And once you click on to those, then you can link it to your ED plan, which would be your A through G plan, and it will tell you if you meet those requirements. It'll tell you if you're below, if you meet, or if you exceed. And then it will give you suggestions as to maybe what to look for, maybe what to implement into your educational plan to make you a better candidate for that specific school that you're looking for or looking at attending. And then the other component is the career portion, and we'll be implementing more of that next or this coming year in fall, and having classroom presentations related to grade levels and having them do some career exploration. And with that, it also links them to majors and it links them to colleges, and it will link them to their ED plan as well. And so it has a plethora of information for the student. The one thing that I really enjoy about it is that I think it will alleviate the anxiety that families and students feel, that pressure and that high expectation of getting into college. And so it's a great tool to help guide them and to give them some information to work off of. It consolidates the information of schools that they're interested in applying to, and then you can click and you send it to your application list that you want to apply. So it organizes the information for the student and for the family as a reference. So it lessens that anxiety and that chaos that can come along with the decision of wanting to apply to a four-year university. Hitting on the at-risk support program at Morro Bay High School, first want to start out by saying that as a counselor, building that relationship and that rapport with the family and student is of the utmost importance. We know that we are the go-to person and for an array of things. And what ends up happening is that, you know, we are, you know, guiding that student. We're the advocate for them. We are the person that's helping them to that goal of eventually walking across that stage at graduation, and then post-secondary goals, helping them implement that for future. So that rapport is so important.
In addition, that in some cases we're not just going to deal with that one student. They have siblings and younger brothers and sisters, so we're going to end up building that relationship for a long period of time in some instances. So how do we reach those at-risk families? Well, first we identify them, and there's several different ways that we identify our at-risk population. And it could be records. An example of that would be you have a family that moves to the area. That CUME file is going to be of importance, and it's going to have information in there for us to use as a reference to find out what's going on in that family. Where have they been? What's been implemented? And from those records, we can put things in place at our site. DNF progress or quarter grades, semester grades, that's an indication as well as to, how the student's doing. And in most cases, tends to be the red flag for us that maybe we need to call that student in and say, hey, what's going on? And from there, it opens the doors of there's some family issues, there's some other issues that need to be addressed and maybe need to be put into action or in place for the student and family. We have our family in transition list that we go off of to be sure that we are following up with those students and implementing any programs that the family needs. Our staff will give us a heads up on a student that they may be concerned about. Johnny doesn't look the same like he always has been in class. Can you please check in with him? And of course, that's a way that we identify our students. At Morro Bay High School, we have a cabinet meeting that meets every other week with our administrators, our student support counselor, which is our drug and alcohol counselor, and the counselors, and we discuss students that we're concerned about, or maybe a certain incident has happened. What do we need to put in place for that student or family? Morro Bay High School, we tend to pat ourselves on the back because we meet with every single one of our students in springtime, not only to just talk about class placement and registration, but goals beyond high school, any personal issues that might be going on, any credit recovery that needs to be put in place, summer school, you name it, everything comes in at that meeting, and we meet with every single one of our students. A crisis may be a situation in where that student's identified as at risk. A student may also self-refer themselves. Sometimes, you have that straight A student that isn't a red flag grade-wise, and they may need someone to talk to because either they're dealing with anxiety or depression, and so we need to put some things in place for that student, and that happens at that time. So we respond either through parent-student meetings. We hold SST meetings, remediation conferences. 504 is listed as a response because we have students who transition to us with already having a 504 meeting, so we've got to monitor, be sure that our staff is up to par in regards to their accommodations and being sure that they're getting implemented and if any changes need to be. So then we intervene and we put things into action. It may be it ranges from, a class placement change to maybe deciding that the student needs to be placed into study skills, or maybe they're a first-generation student, and we're looking at AVID being an intervention for them, so that way that success rate of graduation and post-graduation goals are being met. Credit recovery, referring a student to 504, or for being tested, summer school, our support counselor, as I mentioned, coordinating with outside agencies, our family resource center that we have here on the coast, and we also have our Pirate Plaza that's in place at Morro Bay High School, coordinating to have a safe meeting. And then, there's always that possibility of the student, not making at Morro Bay High School. So what options do we have out here in the community? And an example of that would be, of course, Pacific Beach. So the numbers down below, Morro Bay High School, 153 students, and Slo High, 299 students. Those are the number of students who have been identified and we've responded to. Those are individual. However, I do want to point out that Morro Bay High School has logged 383. So, those are kids that we're seeing on a repetitive amount of time. And same thing for San Luis High, 586. Numbers aren't up there for our number of 504 students that we have or the number of SSTs that we've held both at Slo High or Morro Bay High School. And Gene Harold has those numbers if you're ever interested in getting that information. And then there's also some more breakdown of numbers that Chris could probably provide you that he's been monitoring us in regard to our logs too, and the kids that we're seeing academically, college and career, at risk, etc. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. All right. Thank you.
I have a lot of numbers. And the counselors, before I made this presentation, I went over it with them, and they said, oh, we want this in there and that in there. And I was saying, well, you know, not a lot of people bought John Coltrane's Love Supreme, but everybody bought the Beach Boys. So you want to tell a simple, clean story, you know? You want it to sell. Was that an odd reference? Didn't All right, cool. All right, so the next steps... looking forward into next year and what it is that we want to do, I really like the goals that we've been working on this year, and there's a lot of refinement to do. I want to continue to streamline, I think we should continue to streamline the responsibilities and daily duties of our school counselors. We should continue to develop and articulate counseling programs supporting targeted student populations, and we should continue to develop the ability to analyze and utilize data to improve program capacity. So that's looking forward into next year. So thank you for the time.
Anyone from the public wishing to address the board on this topic? All right. Oh, sorry, Judy. Need to.
Good evening. I'm really pleased to see you in Los Osos. This is great. My name is Judy Neuhauser. I live here in Los Osos. The counseling model has been interesting, and I've really enjoyed listening to what the counseling model has become at the various school levels. I know I'm not at my 3 minutes. the elementary I was interested in said that 70% of the people that they service are SED, which is interesting, and it kind of ties in with something that you'll be talking about a little bit later on the LCAP. And I spent a fair amount of time going through the LCAP comments, but one of the comments that showed up over and over again was the issue of equity, that we differentiate our instruction for students depending on what their needs are, and so perhaps there needs to be a differentiation in terms of funding for counselors according to the need. So take a look at our Title I schools. Are they receiving adequate counseling services for the SED, the high number of SED students that they are working with? I know at Monarch Grove we had what were called wall talks, where we got together two times a year and we discussed every single student, especially those high-risk students. What were the kinds of things that we could do? We had our counselors there. We had our intervention teachers there. And I'm hearing that that's fallen by the wayside. And part of it, I think, has had to do with the fact that the counselors are having to be at several different schools. And so they're not able necessarily to make those meetings because they're having to be at a different school. And I know that was an issue of even getting the counselors to the SST and the IEP meetings, because those are set by the district as to when we have the school psychologist. And if the counselor was at another school, then we didn't have access to that counselor. And I think that's still an issue that is going on within the elementary schools. But I was really pleased to hear from Mr. Scaldi, that you're using that same idea of getting together and really discussing those at-risk students and what are the kinds of programs that you have and making sure that those students are being addressed. That was very interesting to see. This will come out in the LCAP too, that there were quite a few comments in the LCAP, especially in question 4, about concern over loss or continuing loss of time for the counselors in a district. And, I think you'll continue to hear that. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? All right, we'll come back to the board. Mr. Millar.
I just wanted to ask Elena, I'm over here.
Oh, okay.
You made reference to the college planning tool and reducing the anxiety for students and parents about college planning.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get together with the parents in addition to the students?
Well, this is interesting because we've just launched it. We did our AVID group, and then we just launched it to our whole school just this past month, and so we're meeting with them on that. The parents are going to be getting a welcome letter to Naviance over summer and fall, and that's going to introduce them to Naviance at that time. So we're kind of doing it in phases, and so they will be a part of it, absolutely.
Great, yeah. Thank you. I think it's a good program.
Mr. Quisenberry, then Mr. Buckman.
Okay, well, Elena, I'm going to come back to you, and it was just a follow-up to the first to Mr. Millar's question, which is going back to Naviance. Are you planning on having a presentation to the Spanish-speaking parents?
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't mention that. You know, we do classroom presentations as well, and then we do our night presentations to our ELAC. And the classroom presentations range from college and career to self-esteem, time management. And that's another pre-intervention, I guess, that you could plug in there for counseling. Yeah.
Thank you.
You bet.
And now I'm going to pick on Mr. Dowler,
okay.
Which is one of my favorite things to do. A couple of questions. You mentioned the family advocates mainly working at the middle school. Is that their focus?
Our advocates are going out to all the schools.
Okay.
I mean, they're really focused a lot on our elementary and middle schools because they can get in that face time a lot more with counselors and with the school staff, but they meet with all of the school sites on a regular basis.
Okay. Now, do we supply some of our own or some of those folks coming from the link or some other
agency?
Yeah,
so we have two family advocates that work primarily with our school district. The first one is partially funded by Frank's program
okay.
and the PEI grant. So that it's half-time funded here at Los Osos Middle School, and she also works the entire coast, and she is contracted through the link. And then our other family advocate is contracted through Community Action Partnership, San Luis Obispo, CAPSLO, and she works in town with our in-town schools.
Is there, we've talked a lot about collaboration communication. Is there a lot of communication? Do the family advocates get back to counselors and so forth when they've sort of made some connections and so forth?
Yeah, either one of you want to talk
yes.
about that? Anybody?
Yeah,
okay.
Definitely. Our gal is great. She's been a part of our team the whole year, so at our meetings that happen ongoing, she's there biweekly, and then she works really well with our counselors. We've been really happy with the results of our family advocate this year.
Now, don't go away, Mr. Scalvin.
I will stay here.
Okay.
Can I also talk about that real quick?
Sure.
Another thing that they do is, so typically if they – you can refer to our school counsel or to our family advocates anyways. You can call them up. You can email them. They have district email. Typically, they're going to send an email response back once they've been able to make contact with the family or they followed up with that family. They can also enter it into PowerSchool. So there's a variety of different methods to communicate with a counselor and with the school site about how they've followed up on that referral.
Thank you, Chris. Mr. Scalvi, SAP used to be offered through the County Office of Education. They used to have training courses and so forth. Does that still exist, or are we doing this on our own?
Good question.
Well, I went through SAP training long time ago, so I was just wondering if
it is not similar. SAP is Student Assistance Program,
right.
which is the terminology that Frank uses. We've been using PEI, which is, prevention.
Prevention and early intervention.
There we go.
So
prevention and early intervention.
That's the new piece. That's the part that wasn't part of the old SAP model.
Correct.
It's basically a model for integrating the support of a therapist with the school site staff, with the family
okay.
advocate, with Friday Night Live, and they all offer complimentary services to support students and families. The model is basically meeting and organizing supports for students and families on a semi-regular or regular basis.
Yes, so depending on the need for the student and the family, it depends on who might address that. And oftentimes it's multiple entities. It's our school counselor doing one piece. It might be our family advocate doing another. It might be administration getting involved on some level, too. Just depends.
And Mr. Quisenberry,
I've got my 20-year pin. Back in the day, we did used to have, at the high school level, teachers
yeah.
involved in the SAP program, and they were trained, and we had teachers actually running various groups. I don't think we do that as much as we used to. And in fact, I'm not aware of it happening any longer, but it was maybe when teachers had more time in their day, which is certainly an issue we have right now. We had more teachers running some of those groups.
Thank you, Mr. Robinette. It's good to have someone who has institutional memory nearly as long as mine. So the last one is the women's shelter still involved with counseling our students and working with our students?
Yes, absolutely. So the women's shelter, back in the slide back on the elementary school, I showed the number of students referred to women's shelter counselors that are on our campuses in the district. They work in our elementary programs, and County Behavioral Health is the primary therapeutic provider for our secondary programs. So women's shelter has presence on almost every single elementary school campus.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dowler.
You're welcome.
Mr. Buckman, then Mrs. Roger, then Mr. Unger.
Thank you. Thank you. Great, much better understanding of what's going on, and I appreciate it. One quick question, because I'm a real supporter of AVID. So I think Lenny mentioned the referrals to AVID now as a regular outcome.
That we use them as, we can, as long as the student fits the profile, yes, then okay. We refer them to AVID.
Yes, and I appreciate that. So are we seeing an increase in the number of AVID students and AVID classes? Because we're now using them.
It's been steady.
Yeah. Thank you. Mr.
What about AVID?
I'm AVID district director, technically. At Morro Bay, it's been fairly solid ongoing. And at San Luis Obispo High School, the numbers are growing. They're doing a great job.
I'm up. Okay, thank you. Thank you for the this was a great presentation, and you know, it's information that we all, I think, wanted and needed and are glad to receive. The information on Naviance.
Yes.
I had heard the term, had no idea what it meant.
I guess you're supposed to say as Naviance, because it's to navigate. You navigate.
Naviance.
But I prefer Naviance.
They both
like Evian,
like a really
water.
Yeah, it sounds like a perfume you'd like to wear. Either way you say it, but it sounds like a terrific program for kids. I was noting, and I think that other people made mention of it, in the elementary school, 70% of students served are socioeconomically disadvantaged. By the time they get to middle school, we're identifying, where do I want to be here, 49%. 49% by the time they get to middle school. And then by the time they get to high school, 33%. Yeah. Any thoughts on...
Yeah, I have some thoughts about that. I mean, one, it's the difference between the the social-emotional focus primarily in the elementary programs, and as that transition happens, it still maintains somewhat, but the really academic focus of our high school programs, that's why I think it's really important to develop robust tiered intervention models, and that's why growing partnerships, I think, is going to be super important, is expanding our partnerships with programs that specifically target those students. But I notice the same data. I mean, it's right there, exactly.
Yeah.
And again, I attribute that to the academic focus of our high schools compared to the social-emotional focus of our elementary programs.
Okay, because I think we're at 32% district-wide SED,
oh, yeah,
something
there's some
like that.
Ebb and flow, but yeah, I think roughly about 30
around there.
To 32%. 39 on the coast, or right now? Oh, district-wide?
District-wide, 39%.
Okay.
And then just the other comment I wanted to make was just with regard to the importance of counseling, and everybody knows how I feel about counseling, but later on this evening we'll be going through the LCAP and comments that were received via the LCAP outreach. And it seemed that, you know, people had different thoughts about the effectiveness of coaches, instructional coaches, TOSAs, this, that, the other thing, a lot of divergent views. There was no, to my memory, every single comment that had to do with counseling was positive and asking for an increase in counseling services for students. So I would say district-wide, that was my interpretation of the LCAP data, was that counseling is very much appreciated and valued by everyone in the district, because the LCAP responses came from people from all different walks, teachers, administrators, classified employees, what have you. So thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Unger.
I thought one of the most interesting figures was the number of students that were referred to the family advocates. From your numbers, we had 462 students, and that's a pretty significant number of students that were saying need help in the community. And that's my comment. I guess I would just continue to encourage us to make community connections, because if my guess is if we're referring kids for community advocacy, it's probably because they need assistance with food, medical, their medical needs, homelessness, all that kind of stuff. And I would just continue to encourage us to work with those community connections and make sure that our students are well taken care of.
And the family advocate service, a lot of what they provide is navigation of extremely complex bureaucracies. Exactly. And maze of agencies that are out there to support families and hopefully get them in the door to the right service that they need and cut through some of the red tape in order to get the support.
Yep. Okay, Ms. Fowler, I saw you wanted to approach.
I just wanted to make a comment, but there might be a possibility that the 70% that we work with, we might mitigate some of those issues that come up for them in elementary, so their numbers are reduced at the middle and secondary. So I just pose that as a possibility. I think we do a good job.
All right. Anyone else? Mr. Deller, I have a question for you.
Okay.
I know that we've spent some time.
It's like mass. A lot of stand up, sit down. I'm good.
Yeah.
So I'm in my element, man. I'm in my zone. Bring it.
Okay. I wouldn't know. So
good question.
My question is, I know that we've spent some time over the past few years working with establishing and strengthening ties to outside agencies and community connections. And I just wanted to get a sense from you, as we've increased in the family resource centers, as we have worked harder to establish those relationships, what your sense is of how they're doing.
Well,
are the kids benefiting? Are the counselors? Are they working together? Is there appropriate feedback?
I have an isolated view from my hill. I'll be really honest with you. I mean, I see things from I go out to school sites. I don't have the benefit from the ground level that other people might. And I believe that the feedback that I get from the counselors is very positive. I think there's, at a point, there was a misconception that there was an either-or option. Mm-hmm. I believe these services and supports to be complementary. And they've never intended to be an option, an either-or option. They've always intended to be complementary. And I believe that everybody feels that they are, and that's my hope and goal, is that people genuinely are invested in these programs because they support kids. So that's my belief. But I think it would probably be better answered by a counselor who works with our family advocates and therapists every day. Could you answer to that if you see those?
I see a lot of nodding, and that's positive.
Yes, I must agree that we work very closely with our family advocates, and if anything, now that we're at multiple sites, it has been an amazing support. We definitely can use the help rather than us trying to navigate those services for the families. Now we can refer on. So, yes.
Thank you. Thank you. Anyone else? All right. Thank you very much for a very informative presentation. We appreciate it. All right. Next on the agenda is approval of the MEC salary restructure proposal.
It's me again.
It is you.
So A year ago, when we were looking at negotiating with all the other groups, CSEA, SEIU, Confidential, management came forward and said, we're not interested in the $500 that you've given to all these other groups, but instead we'd like you to look at our salary schedule. We feel that there's some issues with the salary schedule, and we have some interests of things that we would like to have fixed, so we would like you to look at that. So they met with Dr. Prater, and Dr. Prater then came forward and asked me to collect some data on salary schedules and relationships of salary schedules. So here are some of the things that that in a good salary schedule, or one that works for a district, these are some of the things you would like to see. First of all, you'd like to see that it's based on data, that your salaries are, you know, paid accordingly to the position, that they are, the ranges are based on the job knowledge, the accountability, the complexity. For example, Dr. Prater's job has higher knowledge, accountability, and complexity than, say, my position, so he should get paid more than I would. The next point being that there should be a career ladder with salary advancement, so administrators should be able to advance through career levels as and move up the salary ladder, and there should be equity between the positions, so they should be related to one another. So one position might make 10% more than another, or 20% more than another, based on the responsibilities that that position holds. And lastly, a salary schedule should reflect the values of the organization. Dr. Prater believes that he wants all of the members of cabinet to have been school principals at one point in time or another. That's a value of the organization that's not always shared by every organization, but it's shared here in this district. So next, I went out and gathered data from all school districts that were basic aid school districts that had student populations between 2,000 and 15,000 and all had to be unified or have high schools included in them. And what the data showed that we are well compensated as a district. Our certificated employees, which is what CE stands for, make about 5% more than comparable districts, and our classified employees make 20% more than the average of similar basic aid districts. So like the teachers and like the other salary groups, our managers are doing well also. One of the questions was, do principals always make more than assistant principals? Because one of the interests that MEC had was in looking at the elementary principals being elevated above those of the high school assistant principal because they have to run a school. So the data did show that the principals in every district that I looked at made more than an assistant principal, regardless of whether they were elementary or high school. Another interest of the district actually shared between MEC and Dr. Prater was to eliminate the position of a dean. So that's one of the recommendations here tonight. And deans didn't exist in most of the districts that we studied. I did ask Dr. Pruitt and Mr. O'Connor to come also here tonight in case you had questions about the dean position later on in this presentation. And then another interest that the district had and MEC jointly was that the director positions would be based on the overall structure and values of the organization. Our current curriculum directors are paid less than the people they evaluate, and that being the middle school and high school principals, and both MEC and the superintendent had an interest in elevating that position of the curriculum and instruction directors. And then we also noticed from the data that smaller districts didn't have classified supervisors on the classified side of the house. So the recommendations more analysis was that I also noticed that there was a pay compression between the positions on the certificated salary schedule. So there wasn't a lot of growth and movement between, say, a middle school assistant principal and a high school assistant principal and an elementary school principal and a middle school principal. They were very compressed, which means, as a result, when somebody promotes, they don't get really much growth in their salary as they move through those positions. You want to see some growth between those positions. Ours typical was an 18% and ours was 10%, so that was a lot closer together. And then I also looked at the across the schedule, and we were pretty much on target. Most districts had a 17% spread between when you enter the position and when you leave the position, and ours was 16%, so we seemed on target there. So the recommendations are, I created set of ranges. So there's 3 to 4% between each certificated administrator. So when you promote from one position to another, there's going to be 3 to 4% difference between those positions. And with 20% overall from the entry-level position to the most advanced certificated administrator, and there was 5 to 10% between our classified managers. The next recommendation was to eliminate the dean position, and again, the two high school principals can speak to that if you'd like to know more about eliminating the dean position, but basically, it's so that you have assistant principals that are all equal and can all share the responsibility of instructional leadership and share the responsibility of discipline and those other duties across the school. And then I also noticed the adult school coordinator. I was asked to look at the adult school coordinator position. Our adult school, you saw a presentation, has grown dramatically, does a lot. And most of the adult schools that we studied fit along the lines of an elementary principal. So that would be a recommendation on the salary schedules that you have. And as mentioned earlier, a recommendation was to create a higher range for the curriculum and instruction director. And we're not recommending any changes to the classified managers. So you have the two schedules in the packet before you, and I am happy to answer any questions that you may have. I think that's the last slide.
Okay, first we'll go to the public. Anyone wishing to speak on this? Okay, bring it back to the board. Mr. Buckman.
Really quickly, and I know the answer to this, but I wanted to sort of somehow get it on the record. It's the timing, and it's, you know, we did measure D. We were clear in our message to the public that this was not going to affect any salaries, and I just want to ask for, just on the record, so
yep.
None of this is coming,
none
even
of
though
this
it's
is
such
coming.
A small end. None of this. Measure D's going to the kids.
Correct. The amount for this is $28,000 for all the administrators, and that is not coming out of Measure D funds.
Thank you.
Remember, and to repeat again, all the administrators chose not to take the $500 that every other person in the organization chose, and instead said, would you apply that money to a restructured salary schedule that makes more sense for us?
Mr. Millar?
Kristen, the two salary schedules, that's salary, that's not total compensation.
Correct, just salary.
And just as an observation, I understand the salary compression piece, but a 10% differential is, you know, not insignificant, and also the person is advancing professionally.
Absolutely, but there was only like a 2% between some of these positions. It was 10% from the very bottom position to the very top position with all the positions in between. That was what the problem was, is people would promote and they really wouldn't get much of a raise. And they were like, hey, I'm taking on a lot more responsibility and I'm not really getting much of an increase in my salary because the positions were so tightly connected. So some of the positions have been lowered a bit, and then just the ones that I mentioned were increased.
Okay, that makes more sense. Thank you.
Mr. Quisenberry.
Well, I'm going to show my abysmal ignorance. Could you bring up the one that says the classified management restructure proposed?
And it's
the same question with the certificated management I have. So in... Yes, the salary schedule. I'm sorry.
So there are ranges listed on the left-hand side.
That's
your question.
That's my question. That throws me off. I see the steps. I assume the steps are commensurate with years. Is that correct?
No, so there is 1% that goes down. So when you look at the classified schedule, for example, the operations supervisor is at range 1. So range 2 is 1% higher than range 1, and then range 3 is 1% higher, and then range 5 is, you know. So each range represents a percent. So in other words, there's 9% between the transportation supervisor and the maintenance supervisor.
Okay.
So it's just so that they are in alignment. What happened with the old schedule is they were isolated positions that were not in relationship to one another at all.
Okay.
These are now all in relationship where you can say this position pays 9% more than this one, et cetera. And then moving across the schedule is 2%. And they move every year on July 1st. So on July 1st, as long as, you know, basically a manager always starts on step 1, and then they move to step 2, and then so it takes them 10 years to get to step 10.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else? All right, it's my understanding that tonight this is a discussion item. You're not asking for any action at
No, that we're asking time. For that you approve the new certificate and salary schedules.
Right.
And these would not be effective until July 1st.
Okay.
So so this would be the major changes. I do want to highlight again. This would be elimination of the dean position. So on July 1st, the deans would become assistant principals.
Right.
And it would advance the curriculum directors to a Director 1 position as indicated on the salary schedule, and it will place the adult school coordinator comparable to the elementary school. So
right.
those are the three major changes, and that would all these changes and all these new salaries would go into effect on July 1st. But the administrators would be placed as at the step of what they're currently making. So other than these three positions, most of them are what they're currently making.
Okay, Mr. Unger, then Mrs. Rogers.
I'd move approval of the MEC salary restructuring proposal.
Okay, and I still have a question. I would like to hear from the high school principals.
Thank you, because they did come here.
That's what I was thinking.
I told them they were on at 6:30, so I'm
sorry,
like
guys.
2 hours off.
Just if you could just briefly speak to how your site would benefit from the abolition of the dean position and the creation of the assistant principal positions?
Well, I'll start by saying that I think it was very telling that we had two deans speak tonight about instructional leadership in our district and did a fabulous job because that's what they do every day. To be very frank, I think the title of dean has never been appropriate to the work that my colleagues do, my co-administrators do, both with Carl Bloom here, I should say at San Luis Obispo High School as I acted as a dean in this district, and also with Chris Jones at Morro Bay High School. Each and every day they're evaluating teachers just as I. They're in classrooms doing formal and informal observations just as I am. They're present each and every day working with teachers and having conversations around instruction. So I think by changing the title to assistant principal, it encourages the community, students, parents and teachers to understand that they're instructional leaders and not just in a position of discipline and attendance and serving in that role. So for myself, I think it just validates the work that they're already doing, and it also creates an equity around the things like discipline and attendance, which we implemented this year at my site, which Chris was open to doing, along with my assistant principal, of splitting the discipline and sharing that responsibility. It's a greater connection with kids for all. So I just saw nothing but positives in this move for my site. So, Mr. O'Connor.
Okay. And I would echo Kyle's comments. On our site, we have 70 certificated employees, a large number of classified employees. You heard earlier from Kristen with regard to the evaluation process. If you're a Track 1 teacher, and I have maybe 10 Track 1 positions, and I'm sitting with them for a pre-conference, two formal observations, post-conference conferences, two informals, and I'm doing that before December the 15th, you can pretty quickly extrapolate out that most of my day could be sitting with a teacher and sitting in the classroom, but at the same time, we've got 70 certificated employees. All have to be evaluated. Our team, myself, one assistant principal, and two deans, we're a team. There's four of us. We divide the work up equally. They are instructional leaders. They're working. Aaron, who presented here this evening, has been working not only with our science department but also with our district to bring next-generation science standards. He's a former science teacher. He knows science. He speaks the language of science. Surely he should be compensated as an assistant principal because of instructional leadership that he has. Same with Mr. Frost. When we look at our discipline and our truancy data, you know, one of the things that I heard when I first took this position, our truancy rate was upside of 80%. If you look at our truancy data now, it's dropped dramatically. It brings the entire district truancy rate down. But they're expected to do that and do certificate evaluations. Oh, and also do classified evaluations and also be at all the events that I'm at. We are a team. They are certificated. They are assistant principals, and they are instructional leaders on our campus. They're viewed as instructional leaders on our campus by our staff and by our community. And I echo Kyle that we should pay them accordingly.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that you came tonight, and I was happy to provide you the opportunity to speak so that your appearance wasn't wasted. And we have a motion and a second, and I have no further comments.
We don't have a second.
Oh, I'd like to second the motion.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mark seconded it.
We have a motion and a second then by Mr. Unger and Mr. Buckman.
Any further discussion? All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Motion carries. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Robinette. Okay.
Should we take a little break?
Should we take a break?
Yeah.
Okay. I see a lot of nodding. 5 minutes. We'll take a five-minute break. No, they haven't yet. It's the planning commission. Okay. Yes, I did. We'd like to reconvene, please. All right, Mr. Robinette, I believe. Oh, you're dealing with technology over there. Okay.
Well, thank you. And I am. This is a daunting task, trying to look at a whole bunch of disparate comments and come up with some trend lines. When I was just sitting here, Dr. Prater asked me first, though, so before I actually kind of get into my little spiel here, to share with you our website and make sure the board and the public are aware that all of this information is out there. We're trying to be just out front about what people are saying about our school district and about our budget and about what this whole thing called local control accountability is all about. So on our website, you can see all of last year's data, all of this year's data, and you can also get a sense of what our stakeholders are saying. So when we go out to schools and talk to people, we record that feedback. When we send out a survey to all of our teachers, we get their comments, and those comments are there anonymously so they can kind of be read. In fact, Ryan, pull up one of those, maybe the survey from this year, so we can just kind of... Yeah, they're both on the board item, so I trust the board has had an opportunity to look at all that stuff. It just, it's really helpful. Some of this has nothing to do with the LCAP and a local control accountability plan, truly. I mean, it's not something that fits within those guidelines. But it's really helpful for us to get a sense of how people are feeling about our school district and our direction and what we're doing. So I'm not going to go through all of that stuff and try to consolidate it, except I do have some conclusions to draw. So anyway, we'll refer back to that if you have specific things you want to look at. I've spent a lot of time reading all of that. But if you can just put on my little short PowerPoint. There we go. There's a classic fable from India. It's hundreds, maybe thousands of years old, about six blind men responsible for describing an elephant. And you all are familiar with this. As the story goes, they are hampered by their inability to correctly see the elephant because they are only grasping one physical element of it at a time. They're holding onto the tail or the trunk or feeling the foot or feeling the hide. And in the 17th century, a poet, John Godfrey Saxe, actually did a whole poem about this. And one of his stanzas was, "And so these men of Hindustan disputed loud and long, each in his own opinion, exceeding stiff and strong, though each was partly in the right, and all were in the wrong." I think it's really difficult when we ask people to comment on the elephant, which is this whole big thing, knowing that everyone is coming from a limited perspective. They're seeing part, but not necessarily the whole. So part of our task in writing a local control accountability plan is to be responsive to our stakeholders, those people in our community that have a vested interest in what we are doing in our school district. Remember, the LCAP is a small part of our budget. It's sort of that over and above stuff, and it's meant to specifically target closing the achievement gap and focusing on those specific subgroups of EL learners, socioeconomically disadvantaged students, and foster homeless youth, while also creating an overall plan that aligns our extra resources with our district's goals and mission. When we ask people, parents, students, teachers, principals, to look at our district and form an opinion, it may be a bit of an injustice, because we know that what we are going to get is accurate. Those perceptions are accurate perceptions. All of our parents, teachers, staff, and students have valuable, valid, and real perceptions to share, but it's difficult for me to sometimes get a bigger picture. So who do we solicit feedback from? Remember, this is not a rewrite year for our LCAP. So we are refining our plan. But we did do a lot of outreach, as we plan on doing every year, to our stakeholders. We did budget presentations and asked for input of all of our school and work sites. We collected feedback anonymously from our staff, particularly through staff surveys. We spoke to our Title I Advisory Committee, our parent booster and PTA groups, and our district English language advisory parents. We talked to our principals and district leaders often. We discussed this in cabinet weekly. This year, we actually did something that we probably should have done last year. We reached out to an amazingly diverse group of students at each of our 5 secondary schools, and we asked our principals, I don't know if they're still here, to just give us a great mix. Don't give us, you know, a few ASB kids. You know, give us students from all over the spectrum at your school, and we certainly got that. Within these groups, there were certainly different perceptions. Between these groups, there are different perceptions. I mean, Kristen and Ryan and I went to 2 elementary schools 2 days in a row, and it was striking. We talked to a staff, and the elementary staff at one particular school said, whatever you do next year, keep the math professional development going the way it is. We love it. And kind of looked around, is that kind of a consistent opinion of this staff? And people were shaking their head. The very next day at another one of our elementary schools, we heard, whatever you do, cut this math PD. It's driving us crazy. Is that a consistent feeling in the staff? Yes, it is. So we know that it's really hard to get true perceptions. But I can generalize a bit, and we do have some generic feedback. If you read through and see, you know that our staff, especially at the elementary level, is feeling overwhelmed. I think we've heard that. I think we can sense it. I think you can read it coming through those comments. We have invested mightily into an instructional model and the supports to align ourselves to the Common Core standards. We have spent time in professional development and assessment training in math, writing, and reading. We have adopted a standards-based report card. We've become a Google district, and it has been a lot. So our staff is feeling overwhelmed. Our staff is also reporting a general desire to continue with the technology push. They want more. We're seeing those requests for more technology in the hands of our staff and students. And our students concur with that. We heard that consistently from our kids. They want that one-on-one. They want that access in our schools. Our teachers want time. Time is of the essence. They want time to collaborate. This is evident in their comments. It's evident in our recent contract negotiations. Our interventions seem to be valued, especially things like reading recovery and LLI. Teachers are concerned with things that we may not be able to address in our LCAP. Class size. We may not be able to address that one, at least in the most obvious way, adding teachers. We may not be able to address adding more counselors. But to be responsive, we certainly shouldn't go backwards in those particular areas. If you read comments, some of our teachers are questioning the value of instructional coaching. But our principal feedback is the absolute opposite. In fact, we polled all of our elementary principals. Our elementary principals see instructional coaching as of the utmost value to establishing the learning climate we are seeking. It's the highest value they place in our LCAP. Parents seem to be largely happy with our school district and with our schools, as evidenced from the feedback at our meetings. And certainly there are some concerns. We have concerns about class size and school climate and behavior issues. But what we heard from all 3 of our groups is they are appreciative of our summer school program that we added in our LCAP. especially echoed from our EL families. They like having the reading interventions in our schools, transportation. We heard from our PTA boosters especially how happy they were that PE specialists were teaching their students instead of classroom teachers being partially responsible for that. Parents believe Common Core is hard, and it's an adjustment. Understanding the expectations and the assessments are challenging, and we got that from our kids also. This is a big shift for them at the secondary level especially. I think a lot of our elementary students, this is all they're getting to know. But at the secondary, adjusting to this kind of more challenging, rigorous, less discreet curriculum is a challenge. So these new expectations are an adjustment there. What is heartening to know is that at all of the schools, all the five of the schools we visited, by and large, our students feel very safe at school, and they like their schools. It's amazing what we heard at all three of our high schools, how much those students liked their school. They like Morro Bay. They like San Luis Obispo High School. They like Pacific Beach. Time and time again from all types of kids. But they actually are perceptive. Our students perceive that classes are different for different kids, that accelerated students may actually have better quality teachers at the secondary level, and their opportunities need to be equalized more. They said that to us. So something we definitely need to pay attention to, especially since our LCAP is all about closing the achievement gap and providing opportunities for all. So the board's staff, Eric and Ryan and me, and especially our instructional services, student services staff, Amy and Kim and Diane and Chris and Kristen, you've tasked us with taking all these disparate perceptions and opinions and creating the whole. We do it as a rich district. I'm not ashamed to say that we are a rich district, a district that has more resources at our disposal than most. The fact is that most of those resources have gone into salary and benefits. We're also a high-paying district for all employees, administrators, teachers, classified employees. It's higher than most. But we are tasked with creating a plan where we actually have a flat revenue stream. We are a rich district, but we're not getting new LCAP dollars, and we've said that over and over. Mr. Pinkerton has been reiterating it over and over. In fact, the 4% raise that all employee groups are getting is pretty much going to take up what we expect to get from property taxes next year. So we are expected to be flat. Whatever decisions we need to make, we need to subtract someplace else if we add. So focusing on our resources is part of seeing that whole elephant, not just the parts. So what have we learned? There's a German term called Gestalt. I don't even know what it means, but I do know in psychological terms it means that there is something that can be discerned where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. The elephant is greater than the sum of all these things people are feeling. So is there something that we can take from these opinions that can truly inform the plan? And we're not discussing the plan tonight. We're just kind of discussing some of these opinions. And I think there are. So what are the common threads? Well, one of the common threads is that we need to focus on practicing what we've learned. At the secondary level, quite frankly, we have some work to do. We need to work especially in science and English language arts. I think that's going to be a little easier than at the elementary level, where elementary specialists are expected to be everything for every student. And at the secondary level, we have specialists, English teachers, science teachers. But at the elementary level, we need to take our foot off the gas pedal a little bit. And we need to allow time to practice what we have learned. Not to put the brakes on, because the momentum we're doing is very good, but we need to not introduce new concepts to our elementary teachers at this point. I think we're hearing that. It's time to hone our skills. We need to take advantage of the collaboration that we are afforded among our professionals and give our sites more autonomy. It was part of our collective bargaining agreement, TCT time. It is a district value. We have great professionals within our organization, so we need to honor their time to work together within their duty day. And we also need to have each of our sites develop plans that are aligned to their particular needs, so that the one school who says, yeah, we need more math, and the other school that says, I think we got it, we're figuring out a way to balance that out to the particular needs of particular teachers at particular sites. We definitely need to give our sites more autonomy. My batch. I should have been part of that at that last one. We have to continue to expand technology for students. We're hearing that pretty consistently in our feedback. Putting technology in the hands of teachers and students. Our model technology classrooms have been a complete success. It's been a good way of going about doing it instead of just throwing a bunch of computers at a school and saying, here you go. We're actually giving it to what we kind of sometimes refer as the omnivores, the people who are ready to kind of, yeah, I'll take on something new and try it and experiment and then use that as a model classroom, an incubator for other teachers to see and experiment with. And as that's expanded, I think it's a good way for us to go. So we need to continue this push. We need to focus our efforts on instruction and student achievement. That's underlined for a reason. You had a presentation tonight on teacher evaluation. But our committee's focus, I hope you sensed it from that committee, was not really on evaluation, because we're not, it's a very collaborative, formative model. It's not about collaboration, it's about instruction. Our Breakthrough Coach Initiative, which puts principals in classrooms more often, our use of instructional coaches, our belief in push-in services more than pull-out services, our whole strategy in Common Core and the workshop model is toward highest quality first instruction and measuring a student achievement aligned to that instruction. So our focus and our LCAP plan is going to be on what's happening on the classroom floor for each of our students. We need to align ourselves to Common Core. I think Common Core has become kind of a bad word and I don't like it, but it's nothing more really than a set of standards that will prepare students for the college and career skills they will need. It's not more complicated than that. And probably most importantly, we should stay the course. While we can always do better, and there are always things we can change, we need to recognize the overarching message from our stakeholders that, yeah, things aren't perfect, but we're on the right course. This thing we call public education is an enormous elephant. Sometimes we cannot see around it. But this board has used a mantra many times, which is all means all. And as long as we maintain our focus on all students, and especially those targeted groups, and do what we can to close that achievement gap, I think we have the right mission. The next board meeting, we'll give you our best shot. We will present our LCAP for a first reading, and I trust that you will be able to see that we've tried to weave these threads through that plan. But with that, I'll leave it up for any questions.
First, we'll go to the public. Anyone wishing to speak on this?
Hi, my name is Judy Neuhauser. So, Rick, I really liked your presentation tonight. And let me tell you the things I really liked. I really liked the idea of honing skills, because that's certainly what I think my experience from talking to my numerous elementary school teacher friends has been, is there gets a point where you can't do anything well if you're not given time to actually consolidate. So that consolidation time, I think, is really critical. The balancing the PD to particular needs. I mean, I'm thinking of people who went through math training with Dale Seymour. And Dale Seymour is very similar to the Common Core kinds of things that we're looking at. So no, they probably don't need it. People who were raised on go through the textbook in lesson one, do all the problems, lesson two, do all the problems, they probably do need it and are finding this as a whole new opening of their minds to what math instruction can be. I have a question about tech, which has to do with computer use. I know that the very last ELAC meeting that I attended at Monarch Grove, and that was about a year ago now, there were parents who had children at the middle school, and a lot of their homework was on computer and internet, and they don't have internet. And there wasn't a bus that they could stay here. And the library doesn't stay open past 5 o'clock many nights. And they were having to run around the neighborhood trying to get access to internet. So that's an issue for especially the socioeconomic disadvantaged. The counting on them having internet is not necessarily true. And we need to be sensitive to that. You know, I was a big believer in Common Core pedagogy. I think it's excellent. What I'm not a big fan of is the SBAC. And I would challenge everybody to go take the writing test for third grade SBAC with a split screen, two articles. You have to scroll up and down and up and down and up and down. You have to cite evidence. They're not told how to cite from different articles. There's not, it's just, I mean, you look at it, and my experience was to throw up my hands and say, I don't really want to do this. And I can only imagine an eight-year-old is going to be feeling very similar types of things. You know, TOSAS, the idea of the TOSAS and the coaches, I was here at that meeting when all of the elementary principals stood up and said they really were totally behind the coaches at their school. But one of the things they said about it is because it would take that particular task off their plates. So, yes, I can see them being supportive of it. What it did is we had gone from a model of 20-1 in K-3, and that was now being put on teachers, as we heard of Monarch Grove students being in classrooms of 29 and 30 students.
Judy, I have to ask you to wrap up.
Okay. So I think if you're looking for money, I'd like to know, I've never seen a number. How many coaches, how many TOSAs are we supporting at the district office who are basically doing now administrative types of things instead of being actually in the classroom on a regular basis teaching?
Thank you. Okay, anyone from the board have any comments or questions? Catherine.
Excuse me, Rick, I just have a quick question about site autonomy. I wonder if you can just speak to how we could go about balancing the need that's perceived at the site levels of needing more autonomy with preparing all the students in the district in the same way with, you know, parity.
Yeah, it's been, and we're really talking at an elementary level largely, because it hasn't been that whole issue has not been a middle school, high school issue, but at the elementary level, as Ms. Neuhauser said, it's certainly an issue. It's been the all-consuming discussion of, I think, three elementary principal meetings in a row is, what does that really mean? So what it really means is that we have some district initiatives that are, I hate to use the word non-negotiable, it's thrown around a lot, but it's our expectations. We have a writing curriculum that has three styles of writing. All students are learning all three of those styles of writing. It's not negotiable. It's an expectation. We're not having a school decide, we're not going to do narrative this year. We're just not going to teach that this year, because those are the expectations found in the SBAC. They're part of the Common Core. But within that idea of, yes, we're all doing writing, schools, we want to give schools that liberty. Do they need to have all their teachers go to the district office and grade that writing together? Which has been our practice a couple of times a year, to look at writing as a cohort, as a grade level team district-wide, all the second grade teachers calibrating the way they're scoring their writing and getting a lot of professional development from that. Some sites will say, you know what, we think our teachers have it and this is a good use for our TCT time. That's when the teachers would like to use that time to grade together, or maybe to get together with another school across town, Baywood and Monarch, you know, a mile or two away from each other, to do that work instead of at the district office. So we're having principals and management teams develop that idea of how they're going to implement those same expectations, but maybe not with the district saying, this is where you need to go today. The way staffs use their faculty meeting time, to a great extent this year, we dictated a lot of that from the district office, because we wanted to, in one of our six parts of the LCAP is becoming a data culture, and part of that is learning how to do the standards-based report card. We actually dictate a lot of what those faculty meetings needed to look like this year. Next year, we think our principals have it, and so if they need our support, we'll be there. If they feel like they can take those meetings on their own, it's fine. So it's a little dance, because the expectations aren't going away, but we think our teachers can practice now. and the expectations for what students need to know and be able to do are not changing per site. We are unified in that.
So it's more style than content. It's, they're giving
The how more than the what.
Okay, thank you. That was very helpful. Mr. Buck. Oh, Dr. Pruden.
I was just going to say it's the artistry of leadership, not just with our principals, but with the sites. How are they going to shape their daily work, their culture, their meeting times? I think it's important we give that task back to the very people that are in the trenches every day. And I think the, I think we'll be impressed. I'm already impressed with some of the creative thinking I see going on among principals and teachers. It's really great stuff happening. It's not fully formed yet, but we'll get there.
Thank you. I've got four questions on very little tiny things, and if it's all right, I'm just going to submit them to the superintendent, and we'll just deal with it that way. But there are just some gem little remarks that I'd like more on. Thank you.
I have a question, Rick. Can you tell me about the response percentage in terms of teachers or how many people responded
to
the...
I think we counted them all last year, and I reported that. I didn't count them this year. I don't know. How many of our staff members responded? I don't know what the percentage.
Now, on the survey or on our... So we did two things really key in terms of the staff response. So one was... an anonymous survey. I think there was 100 people that did the survey, so not a ton.
That's not a lot.
We put it out a ton.
The
day after, every single time we had a meeting, the following day, I gave them all, I emailed them, every staff member, a copy of the information, the website, where things were at, as well as the survey link. We even redid it two other times. And say, hey, this is last week. Now, that said, when Rick and I and Kristen would go to a school site, we would vet the same questions out to the entire staff. So when you go and look at the data, in terms of the school site and has all the specific information on it, so all of the staff was there to participate in that survey. So the other survey was just more of an anonymous way that if they felt like they couldn't say things, maybe, not want to talk about their coach and the coaches in the audience or things like that, that they could say things in that anonymous survey. So that's what that was for. But I really feel like most people had an opportunity to share at the staff meeting, and we listed all of their input on that.
I think, though, if I can just add on to that, it's, as I said before, I wish I knew the best way to go about this, because it is a bit of a disservice sometimes to go to a staff and say, here's our budget, here's what we're doing, what do you think? People need time to process, and understanding a budget is not an easy thing. Understanding all these rules and regulations for LCAP, which we truly don't go into with great detail because we have a short period of time, and, we're really trying to get a sense of how are we doing, what... Are we doing okay? What could we be doing more of or less of? And truly, we're just getting a piece of the elephant from different perspectives. And so I'm not sure a survey is the best way, or going out to school sites and just kind of being like that is the best way. If I knew the best way to really get input from our staff, we'd try it. But I think we had less responses this year than we did last year.
Yeah, that was my impression from reading. However, knowing that you included the information you received from meeting with the groups is very helpful. I appreciate that. And I'm making the overt effort to try different things and say we're trying to get your feedback.
The student piece was really helpful for us. And maybe we'll try it with upper elementary students. It's the younger the student, the harder it is to really get that true perception of quality of education and things. But our high school students, especially, they're spot on with what they're seeing.
I attended the San Luis High student meetings, and they were really interesting. All the various groups.
Sure. Yeah, I just wanted to really thank you for getting out and talking to the students. It's nice to hear that they feel safe at school. I think from what we heard from Mr. Warren tonight, that that's, we're getting that same feedback, I think, from this Healthy Kids survey. It really concerns me if students themselves, though, feel like there are different levels of quality in the education they get. And to hear that that is a belief at the schools, that's very disturbing, and I'm sure it's disturbing to the administration too, so I'd like us to continue to focus on that.
Focus on instruction. It's so important.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Anyone else? All right. 8.04, Measure D, approved contract for advisory oversight services.
So as I mentioned earlier, we had a fantastic study session. I mean, I hope you feel the same in terms of last time and going through. We had a great opportunity to discuss program management for Measure D. It's my belief, and we'll be bringing a recommendation to the board at our next meeting to hopefully, with the board's approval, move forward with an in-house program management. We were very fortunate to have some really key outstanding employees working with us that have already begun to establish the procedures and policies that, and projects for Measure D. Now, that said, we've also solicited the services of Mr. Ron Holcomb, who's here tonight and can answer questions should the board have them. You got an opportunity to meet him Friday and kind of hear about his experiences and his abilities and kind of the ways that I think he will provide some overall kind of being an advisor to us and really critical in these initial stages, I think, of Measure D as we move forward with our policies and our procedures and how we do things to really bring him on board and to help us get that established. This contract before you tonight is, though it says can go over 5 years, is really a one-year contract. So my goal is that over the course of this year, we'll be updating you about Ron and his services and how he's been helping us so that we can, again, in the end, get the most out of our Measure D dollars for our students. So in what Ron and I kind of talked about was after this first year, really assessing where we're at with the program, the overall budget, cost, those types of things, and that we would come back to the board at that time, and should we want to continue his services, the board want to continue his services, that we would kind of renegotiate where we're at for the following year. So that's kind of my basic synopsis about kind of where we're at and his services. Again, you got to hear from Ron in how he'll tie in, and again, he's here should you have any questions about the contract or about where we're headed.
Is there anyone from the public who wishes to address this? All right, back at the board, any questions? Mr. Millar?
Well, I think since Ron is still here after 3.5-hour board meeting, it speaks a lot about his patience and love of board meetings. I was part of the subcommittee that met with Ron ahead of time, Marilyn and Ellen and I, and it was a very, very helpful meeting, and I think Ron, and as we discussed at the Measure D meeting, will bring a level of oversight and assistance to our folks, and I agree with you completely. We are very fortunate, not just fortunate, I think we owe it to our gratitude to our superintendent, who often works quietly but ends up getting things that he wants. That we have the right people and the right seats on the bus, and we're going to have somebody to help us in the first year and perhaps longer than that.
Absolutely.
in maintaining our concentration on getting the most for our taxpayers out of their very generous support of us improving our comprehensive high schools and our other facilities, and I would like to move approval of Mr. Holcomb's contract.
I'd like to second it. Is there any further discussion, Mr. Unger?
Well, I appreciate what you said, Mr. Millar, because I in our conversation last Friday with Mr. Holcomb, I think it was real clear that the taxpayers of San Luis Obispo and Morro Bay and Los Osos have really mortgaged their homes in order for us to have better schools. And that means that we have a particular responsibility to them to do the best we can with our tax dollars and to get the most bang for the buck. And I'm convinced that Mr. Holcomb can help us with that.
Mr. Quisenberry.
Yeah, I just want to say that if I do abstain from this, it's because I missed that study session, and it has no reflection on Mr. Holcomb or the contract that the district is proposing to sign with him.
Thank you. Any further discussion? We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstain?
One is
one.
Aye. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holcomb.
Staying.
Yeah, your tenacity is immediately evident. All right. Mr. Robinette, 8.05, proposed revisions to board policy.
Moving on. Okay, we have two proposed board policies that we feel it's timely to get in front of the board. One's a major revision and one's a minor change we're suggesting. These are first readings. You can certainly adopt them tonight, but it's not necessary to. The first one is a policy that is, you know, you might as well just toss the old one, and I don't know if it's word. We always do strike out and underline, but this is the newest language. This is directly from CSBA, so we didn't make any adjustments to this on. It's a student policy, so it falls in the 5100 category of board policies, and it has to do with non-discrimination and harassment. So I'll just kind of go through the sections of it, and then if you want to, you know, discuss any of it, we can. The first section is kind of that board desire. This is, you know, the board desires to provide safe school environments free of this, and it mentions all the protected classes that is, you know, now common in the law. Then in the third paragraph, it goes into definitions of what unlawful discrimination, including discriminatory harassment, intimidation, bullying, etc. So we have a definition clause. The paragraph right below that, it kind of broadens that definition. It talks about unlawful discrimination also including disparate treatment. So while the paragraph above is kind of the overt actions, the things you have to avoid doing, I take that disparate treatment to be the things of, you know, anything that would be exclusionary, mm-hmm. Keeping students from participation in any of our programs. The last paragraph on that page talks about retaliation for complainants, so that to make sure that students, faculty, people are protected when they issue a complaint. Then on the following page on section B, we have a section that just says the superintendent or designee's responsibility as far as information about this, how one finds out about it, what the complaint procedures are. And then lastly, there was a paragraph, that talks about disciplinary procedures. So the last paragraph is the types of discipline up to and including that would be included in this. So that's the gestalt, I'll use that word again. Are there particular questions, though, that you would want addressed here?
First, would anyone from the public like to speak to this? Right, seeing none, Mr. Buckman, then Mr. Millar.
Thank you. Rick, as I read this, and you just mentioned anything that would stop a student from fully participating, and I'm going to apologize. I can't remember if when I read it, but I'm not seeing it. A lot of the ed code and policies that I'm picking up on are now including the pupil fees as one of the terms they would like to see in these things, and I don't know.
Yeah, we have.
I don't know if I'm right or wrong. So.
No, we actually rewrote our. You know, student fee policy and brought mm-hmm. that to the board, I think, mm-hmm. a couple years ago.
Right.
And so, and it's part of UCP procedures and everything. So I think we've already addressed the, you know, free access to education and student fee issue.
Okay. And again, I think in here there's something about sharing this with the community. Mm-hmm. I would like to possibly suggest, or maybe it should go in the ARs, that we also include, because this is so important, I'd like to know your opinion on sharing this with, like, the police, the city councils, the board of supervisors, the sheriff, and the CHP. So they're sort of on board and understand how we're working, and that probably go as well for the. I'd like to know your reaction to also including maybe in the next one. I noticed in the bullying that there was a way for students to anonymously report on bullying.
Yes.
And I don't know if this is, it would be in the ARs for this, but I'm not seeing that in this harassment policy. I thought that was a great idea. And those are my comments on this one. Thank you.
Mr. Millar, then Ms. Eisendrath Rogers.
I guess my only question is, what is lawful discrimination?
So we don't need the unlawful in here, do we? I don't know.
I'm
not sure.
Racked my brain.
Just grabbed the language. I don't know what lawful discrimination is. Yes.
Yeah. So, but otherwise, I'm fine with policy.
This may or may not have to do with the actual writing of this, but let me just ask you this. Earlier this year, there was some discussion about how parents and students can access this information really quickly and easily on our website. And apparently it took two or three clicks for us to a student to do that. And I was wondering if we could do it the way so they can do this in one click. Does this relate to board policy, or is this more of an administrative suggestion?
Yeah, I don't know. Is that the board's desire to figure out a way to get this within one click from a website? We could probably figure it out.
Do you know what I'm referring to?
No.
It's had to do with the county office has a way of, when you first go to their website, you have a concern on bullying, you can with one click get to that information, and it takes ours a few more. It may or may not have anything to do with this. I just wanted, while we're talking about this, bring this to your attention. So a tab, yes.
I would actually suggest on like the school page website, so like San Luis Obispo High School, mm-hmm. that they have something, you know, they can have a little one-click type of thing that brings up the policy and information, so which is probably the website that gets visited more. You know, would be actually on the school site website. So that it would probably be a good idea for us to look into something like that, especially the ability to anonymously give information out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we have an interest in acting on this tonight, or would the board prefer to have it come back for a second reading? Then we need a motion.
Well, I'll move approval of board policy 5145.3, non-discrimination / harassment.
I would second that, but I would ask that I would agree with Mr. Buckman that that I'd like to see language here relating to the ability to anonymously report as we do in the next board policy. I think that's real important to say that. So maybe I should be bringing it back for a second reading if that needs to be included.
Okay. So you'll withdraw your motion?
I'll withdraw my motion.
Okay. All right. So we'll revisit this at our next meeting.
Is there anything else that I need to make sure I include within the board policy? Anonymous reporting.
Leaving unlawful.
Leaving unlawful is fine. Thanks, Mr. Millar.
All right, we ready to move?
We have to talk to CSPA about that.
Ready to move on? All right.
This is a simpler change. The board adopted a good policy on bullying a couple of years ago. I think it was 2013. So I think all the language is right, but we've found it tricky in practical purposes because of the reporting and complaint policy. So if you scroll down, Mrs. Holmes, you'll see a couple suggested changes that have to do with how it is that we would encourage complaints to happen. The board policy, again, comes from CSBA, which recommends complaints going through the uniform complaint process. And we know that according to Ed Code, according to the CDE, it's up to individual organizations to figure out what how best to process complaints, as long as we're following all the rules and regulations, and as long as ultimately people can get to the CDE or get to the Office of Civil Rights or know how their appeal processes work. The uniform complaint procedures are best used for allegations of the school district either not doing something under the Williams Law, sufficient textbooks or cleanliness or facilities, or with things that are federally or state funded, programs that are funded by the state and federal government. And our UCP forms actually, they give the school district 30 days to respond, 60 days to form a complaint. And when it comes to things like bullying, it just doesn't seem consistent with the immediacy of follow through and kind of the simplicity of follow through. When we look at our sexual harassment ARs, and I probably should have brought the ARs so you can see it, kind of delineates, maybe that's what I need to do to provide for you in order to consider this. It kind of provides some steps for our administrators that are pretty immediate, and it provides a good complaint procedure for parents, for students, in how to process these things so that anonymity is considered for the student, if that's important. Separation from other students, if that's a consideration as part of the investigation, that's in our sexual harassment complaint procedure. The fact that this is all going to get resolved within a two-week period, not a 30 and 60-day period. It just seems like for us, practically, the AR, that the idea that this needs to go through a uniform complaint procedure if a student is saying, you know, I'm being bullied, it just adds these levels that I don't think are helpful for our administrators, for our families, for our students. So, we actually spoke to Lozano Smith about this and said, you know, do we have to use UCP for bullying? No, you have to use a good complaint procedure so that people know how you're going to follow up on their legitimate concerns. So that's where our changes come from. This kind of comes from Mr. Dowler, from our deans, and from our elementary principals on how to follow up with this. So those are our suggested changes, to not tie this to a uniform complaint, even though ultimately it could end up there if somebody wanted to appeal to that point, but to have this go through a simpler process for us.
Is there anyone from the public wanting to talk about this? Okay, Mr. Buckman and Ms. Roger.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm
that's Mr. Buckman and Mr. Millar. Sorry.
You okay?
Oh, I just have a real quick one.
Go for it.
I think the within one business day is too lenient. I think we should work language in there to the effect that promptly or at the latest one business day. I can envision situations where it needs to be reported immediately. There may be the need to bring in outside resources, including law enforcement. That's, and otherwise, I'm fine with the policy change.
Promptly or at minimum one. At the latest one. Sorry.
Thank you. Rick and I have had some discussion prior to this short discussion. I have to say that while I'm not an attorney and I'm not CSBA, when I looked, I found something called policy. It's the UCP checklist that CDE recommends districts use to create their uniform complaint procedures, and I'd just like us to slow down a little bit, because it seems to me that bullying is one of the things that can be used with the UCP. Just at a gut level right now, I'm a little bit concerned that if there's one principal that perceives something as dramatically bullying and starts moving forward on it, and we have another principal that's perceiving it in a different way, that may create some discrepancy in how students' complaints are handled, whereas the UCP has a very sort of laid out timeline and method. For example, to Mr. Millar's point, under the UCP, you have as much as 60 days within which to file a complaint. So, you know, putting it under any immediate type thing, just that sort of scares me. And I would ask the board to, if I could, I could maybe frame some questions and work on this. But I just, finding this document, just, I mean, the word bullying appears in here pretty often for the uniform complaint procedure.
So I'm confused about what you're actually requesting.
I'm requesting that we not approve this tonight until either there's more discussion or I can submit some of my questions rather than trying to take up.
Well, perhaps then all the questions could be shared with all of
us. Oh,
I
would. Yes, I think that was our new policy. So, yeah, okay. It's okay.
And this is a first reading, so.
And perhaps if I can interject, maybe it would be helpful if at Friday notes, this Friday or following, right before we meet again for a board meeting, I provide the board with both our board policies and ARs on uniform complaints and on that the sexual harassment one, because really the idea is to be more responsive. UCP basically says, "Hey, you got 30 days, investigate this." And our intent here is to be more responsive. So, but let me give you that, both all of that information, so you can see that.
Mr. Millar, then Mrs. Roger.
Well, I think some of both Mark's concerns and mine could be cured with the AR. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that an AR. Are you speaking about the harassment?
Yes.
Section? I mean, do we need an AR specific to bullying? I don't know. I guess what I'm worried about are those infrequent, even though it doesn't feel like that if you watch cable news, situations where there's some activity and then there's some repercussion, some injury or self-inflicted injury to a student based on it. Now,
yes.
From what I've read, and it's a lot of those situations arise from a chronic pattern of bullying. But you know, it's almost like a mandatory reporter kind of situation. If a school employee has a student tell them that they've been bullied or treated in that way, I think it needs to begin having official action more quickly than, and just the title, Uniform Complaint Procedure, is daunting. So that's my concern.
Yeah, I.
Mrs. Roger?
I'm off on a whole different thing.
Would you mind if I respond to Mr. Malone?
Not at all.
Okay. So, Walter, I hear exactly what you're saying, and I agree 100%. In fact, there's a new law that last year that says, and I think it was actually in the policy that says staff must intercede immediately if they see something going on. And I'm not saying to slow down anything that's going to help a student.
No, I know.
It's just the process that might be used. So you're starting to make me think differently, and I appreciate that. I'm worried about some of the references that go into the UCP are federal and not ed code, and I feel like I need some better understanding of whether we're going to be okay if we stop using the UCP.
Well, and I would just the consistency issue that you brought up between sites, I think that can also be addressed in the
certainly.
If you basically say, if you get a report of bullying, you're going to do this and that, it doesn't matter whether I feel like it is really bullying or not. You take the discretionary decision making out of the site administrator's hands. But I'm not opposed to the process involved in the uniform complaint procedure. It's just that I think we need okay, good. All right. And whether or not we need a separate AR to support this board policy is kind of an open question, and I don't know how the other board members feel about it, but I'll let you guys noodle it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, here's me over here, and I just wanted to say, as I read through this previously, and it took me a while to find the paragraph again, but it says, as appropriate, the superintendent or designee may collaborate with law enforcement, courts, social services, mental health services, or other agencies and community organizations in the development and implementation of joint strategies to promote safety in schools, in the community, and to provide services for alleged victims and perpetrators of bullying. And when I first read that, I thought that it was a kind of a highly enlightened paragraph that realizes that both the bullied student and the perpetrator are needy of help. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to support, or I wanted to say I appreciate that, because it is hard to feel sympathetic to a bully, but a bully needs assistance as well as the victim. So that's my two cents on that.
Yeah, I'm listening to the discussion we're having. I think we're all asking for the same thing. So when you're thinking about this, I think what we're asking for is the ability for students that feel bullied to have a process and a procedure that works, that works quickly and works efficiently and can help mitigate the situation right away. And this also provides us with the teeth that says this is how the district will respond. So if somebody questions us, if we're doing our job, we shouldn't have, when we have the problems, they should be able to be taken care of, and hopefully not have to have somebody report us to the Office of Civil Rights, because we know that that's what will happen, and we want to make sure that our students are taken care of here and now.
So with Chris's ever wise advice, what I'm thinking of, there are sections within the Uniform Complaint Procedure that specifically the wording is there, it's all there. So maybe a lot of that work of coming up with something that may be quicker but has specific outcomes that somebody can expect. So that may be a way to take care of this. The report will, the findings of fact, conclusion of the law, disposition of the complaint, all of that, those words are here in the Uniform Complaint Procedure and others. So maybe there's just a, maybe we just need to look at both of them and get it done.
Just one more comment, if I may. I agree, Mark, that the procedure, the uniform complaint process, not to repeat procedure, could be the outcome that the site is going to follow ultimately. For me, it's more about getting the information to where it needs to be, so whatever immediate action, if any, needs to be taken to it. So, thank you.
So are you clear? You have a somewhat puzzled
I'll figure it
expression.
Out. And if I have it wrong, you'll tell me. So
yeah.
It's fine.
Okay. All right. Thank you. 8.07.
All right. I'm going to stay up here for another one. We have...
it's so much fun, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We have only one unique position in our school district that actually answers to two boards. And almost everything this position, whoever occupies this position, sometimes has to live in both of these camps, and that is our Director of Personnel Services, Kristen Newland. Anytime we make any changes to the job, or it has to go before both the Board of Education and the Personnel Commission, you rarely, in fact, you never see classified personnel descriptions come in front of you, because we have a Personnel Commission that deals with that almost every meeting. They actually review job descriptions as a regular basis. All job descriptions within the classified service are reviewed every 5 years, believe it or not. So every position gets reviewed. It's time for Kristen's position to be reviewed, but we can't have the Personnel Commission be the only body who says, yep, that's right, that's what she does. So you have to also do it. The changes are basically things that have been added to the position over the last few years, over the last 5 years, basically, and they are that that the personnel office now, as opposed to the payroll office, manages benefit administration, so that comes out of HR. We've added the idea that and this has been the case for a long time, that the personnel director will evaluate staff, evaluate certificated staff. Kristen evaluates principals as part of her duties. And we've added that something that's been in place for, a good 10 years, but it's just never been in the job description, is that our personnel director is our exposure control officer, because that's the first place people would go if there's a fear of a bloodborne pathogen. You know, there's procedures that we have to go through that actually come through personnel for HEP testing and all those kinds of things. So those are really the main things that have been added to the job description. Otherwise, it stays as stands. And you would need to approve this same thing that we'll be asking our personnel commission to also approve. And I think it's coming to you first. So if you have any questions, I'm happy to address them.
Anyone from the public wishing to discuss this? Back to the board. Any discussion? Shall we act on this tonight? Let's do. Jim?
I move approval of the revised Director of Personnel's description, position, supervision, and essential functions.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? I know our meeting has gone long. When I've used up the battery on my iPad, it just died.
I'm down to 19%.
Okay. Next is 8.09, approved board member's salary for permissible absence. 8.08, approved secondary school schedules.
Yeah, I'm up here to talk about that.
Yeah, I didn't think you were up here to talk about it.
Actually, the last one, I want to say, Jean, she's retiring on June 30th, so she's making sure all of her tasks are done.
Yeah, she's amazing.
So this is the approval. You do this once a year, approve the secondary school schedules. So all of the staffs at Laguna, Los Osos, San Luis High, and Moore Bay have voted on their schedules, and basically there's no changes from the previous year, and we wanted this to come before you.
Anyone from the public? No? Mrs. Rogers.
Oh, your light's on now.
I know. I was going to make a motion. Did you have a comment?
I just wanted... Is the 65% at Loam's, is that down from previous years? I don't remember a vote that low before.
Well, I think you had the sixth graders added to Loam's, and so there's been some differences between sixth grade and then what seventh and eighth grade's doing. And so I know this last year there was a lot of discussion about schedules, and so that could be reflective of that. I don't know if...
Okay, thank you. That
Okay, then I'll move approval of the secondary school schedules for the 2015-16 school year.
Second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstain? Now,
8.09. You got me, Jesse?
Good.
Mr. Unger, as part of his CSBA duties and responsibilities, was unable to attend the March 20th board meeting, and this agenda item is before you to approve his absence.
Shouldn't we bill CSBA? Isn't this like an unfunded mandate kind of thing? Go ahead, Ellen. I'm sorry. I jumped the gun.
Anyone from the public wishing to address Mr. Unger's absence at a board meeting? No. Seeing none. Motion.
I'll move approval of the board absence.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Abstention? Mr. Unger abstains. Moving on to the action consent agenda, please let me know if you'd like an item pulled. 9.01, approved certificated and classified personnel items. 9.02, disposition of surplus property. 9.03, acceptance of donations. 9.04, approved furniture and equipment requests. 9.05, approved purchase orders. No one? Anyone? Nothing?
Pull 901.
Really?
Quickly.
All right. I need a motion for items 9.02 through 9.05, please.
So moved.
I'll move approval of 9.02 through 9.05.
I'll second.
You guys can duke it out. Yeah. Kim will make be the deciding vote.
So, I'll second. Mr. Unger, I think, moved it.
Yeah, for the second, Mark. All right, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstained? Marilyn, 9.01.
Yeah, I just wanted to take a moment to mention that the board mourns the passing of John Geiselbrecht, a very dedicated math teacher in the district and someone who died far too young. And so our hopes and prayers and sympathies and condolences go to his family. I'm sure I speak for everyone sitting on the dais. And that said, I'll move approval of 9.01.
I'll second. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Anyone have a topic for advanced agenda? Mr. Unger.
Yes. I would like to get a consensus from the board to direct Dr. Prater to provide what I would call methods for us to express concern over safety of railroad traffic through the boundaries of the district. I'm looking at this list that we were given. There are 31 schools on this list in San Luis Obispo County. Although there are 5 schools listed in our area, I would also include the district office and the IMC. And I do believe that I have safety concerns about this, and Dr. Prater, I would ask that you provide us with some alternatives for expressing those.
How would you like to...
I'd like to start, Dr. Prater, with a report in the Friday notes, if you would, please, and then we'll see where we want to go from there, I think.
Could I add to,
yes,
to Chris's request? I'd like to see some facts in the discussion or in the information as well, and among those, I'd like to know what grade crossings we have within our school district, meaning where the railroad track crosses the road. And then I'd also like to know what, if any, plans is. I believe is it Santa Fe or Union Pacific who owns these tracks?
Union Pacific.
I'd like to know what maintenance changes would be made if we have an increase in rail traffic, et cetera. And along with the information that Chris is requesting.
Do we have consensus to follow up on this?
Would you mind if I tag along with Mr. Millar?
Sure.
We'll
still ask consensus, but go ahead.
Yes, we will have consensus. But I also sometimes think about this and wonder if there's possible mitigation from a company the size of Phillips 66, and if that question could possibly be looked at. And just, Mr. Millar, and one of the facts that I know of is if this were to occur somewhere near or between French Hospital and Sierra Vista, there would be no hospitals available within our boundaries. But I'm mostly interested in if there's possible mitigation, and I fully support Chris's.
Okay.
And if just to clarify, you're looking for a report within board the Friday Focus.
Yeah, I think that's where I'd like to start with this.
To begin there?
Mm-hmm. And so we can, I think we need to review what our options are. And
I'd like to indicate that because it sounds as though this may require talking to some people and gathering information, that I personally, if it's not this Friday, that's okay. You know, that this is a big job. So
yeah, thank you.
So I just wanted to be clear that, you know, oftentimes we make a request for something in Friday Focus, and I know you get it to us that same week. And I think that's a should not be the expectation this time, if that's all right. I'd rather have a thorough and, you know, talking to people on both sides of this issue so that we have information from from the carriers, from the from Phillips 66, from, you know, I don't know, whoever, wherever you need to go about this issue.
Yeah, given the really this brochure is helpful as a starting point, and I know that we've been asked, San Luis Coastal has been asked to host the next superintendent, county superintendent's meeting here, actually at Loam's, and so I will raise this as an agenda item for that meeting, and we can discuss this as a county group of superintendents, and I think because it impacts us all.
Yeah.
So I will gather information and provide a report. That meeting is May 8th, so I will let you know my status from week to week, depending
Perfect.
On where I'm at.
Okay, thank you.
If I can.
Yeah.
I appreciate the workload that this would create. So I have a question, because the Board of Supervisors, and I'm not sure what their agendas look like, we'll be writing or voting whether to approve or disapprove the because this falls under their jurisdiction, the new railroad spurs down at the Napomo refinery. So I don't know if that adds any urgency. So my question then to administration is, or to the board, is can the superintendent write a letter without us voting on it? So he's just expressing the concerns or something. Just a question. I don't know.
I think it's my understanding that this needs to go before the Planning Commission, and that it hasn't even been, the Planning Commission hasn't even approved it. So I think we're, the groundswell is forming, but I think it's my understanding we're a ways away.
Okay.
And I think we're a little early for
that. Yeah, no, I think that's great. I'm sorry, I was informed Board of Supervisors, so thank you.
I mean, I could be wrong, but that's my understanding, is it needs to go to the Planning Commission. Yeah. All right, anything else? Board reports.
No, I'm sorry, I had two. Just, and I don't think these necessarily have to be advanced agendas, I'm just not sure how to do it. I'd like to see somehow if we can include the term vaping and synthetic drugs or marijuana. The vaping has not been voted on at the state legislature, but in Sacramento. But there are districts that now are doing it on their own, and they're including it in their tobacco and drug board policies. So, just something to look at there. And
We address e-cigarettes and I don't remember the exact language, vapor-emitting devices. We did put that in our tobacco policy.
Yeah,
we adopted
that.
Thank you.
I don't know if it covers everything you're talking about, but I think we tried to make it as extensive as we could.
So then the only other thing would be synthetic marijuana, which is now illegal statewide. But and then the other one is since there are other sections of the California Healthy Kids Survey that we did and we paid for and we have the results, I don't know how we would do it because there's several of them, but maybe as somewhere on the agenda or somewhere in the Friday packet we could get those other results, because one of our major things is a culture of caring, and this actually would give us statistical information on that as opposed to just anecdotal.
So Mr. Robinette, you're nodding. Do you have that information? It just wasn't presented tonight. Okay.
This Friday. No.
Right. Anything else for advance agenda? Board reports. Right. Yeah, it's time to go home. Let's adjourn this puppy. All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for hanging in there. Thank you.
The old days.